listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland.
100.7, let's see, where would that be? That'd be in the valley.
Valley.
Mm-hmm. And if you're in the gorge, it's 91.9. Okay, one anomaly. That's okay, it still works. And you can tell your friends that they can check us out at www.kboo.fm. Good morning, it's Monday. This is More Talk Radio, and
today,
I'm here with Cecil.
Today is December 12th, 2005. It is approximately 7:40 a.m.
It's going to be a sunshiny day.
And it's kind of nice.
I don't know if I call
brisk.
It's brisk. Yeah, not like the tea. More like a breeze. It's got just
breezy.
A hint of a chill on it, you know. Something like that.
This morning, we invite you to join us in our conversation about China. Also, you may have listened to the news this morning, heard something about the WTO summit. Some of you might have participated here in Portland at a rally on this past Saturday. Our guests will talk about China and its role in the world, and we'll have Michael Zelenziker.
That's close.
At approximately 8 a.m.
Uh-huh. And who is this guest of ours today?
He is a visiting scholar at the Institute of East Asia Study, University of California, Berkeley. An extensive career. He was a Tokyo-based bureau chief for Knight Rider Newspapers. He worked for the San Jose Mercury News and numerous other papers. He's written extensively about Asia, including the social, economic, and political trends in Japan, Korea, China, and Southeast Asia. He's completing a book entitled Shutting Out the Sun, which explains the nature of Japan's lost decade. But we won't talk about Japan this day. We have extensive research and history reporting on Asia. So he'll join us this morning shortly after the 8 o'clock hour.
And that'll give you an opportunity to ask any questions you may have about China's role in the trade world here, as well as concerns regarding some of the human rights issues also tied to trade. You got any announcements?
Announcements?
Oh, good. Then I'll read mine.
Okay. Oh, wow. I'm so glad he's here so I can read mine.
Well, no, I mean, it wasn't like that at all. Actually, I'll share with you.
Well, let's
see. Okay. I'll read this one, and then you can read that one. This one actually doesn't take place yet, but you kind of just want to know about it because it gives you a chance to put your ducks in a row so that you'll be able to help. It's called Project Homeless Connect, a day to reach out, a day to learn on January 17th. On Tuesday, January 17th, 2006, hundreds of volunteers and community groups will gather at the Memorial Coliseum to launch Project Homeless Connect, connecting Portland's homeless community with much-needed medical, dental, legal, addiction, and housing counseling service.
Mm-hmm.
Help will be provided by professionals volunteering their services on-site as well as other community volunteers who want to lend a hand. This is where you come in.
Exactly.
A day to learn. Okay, harness the energy and compassion of volunteers to offer care to the more than 2,300 homeless people who sleep on Portland streets at any given night. You will have a chance to learn about the causes of homelessness and how to support our many great local organizations that help the homeless all year. A day for new beginnings. Project Homeless Connect began a year ago in San Francisco, and now thousands of volunteers engage six times a year to help thousands of homeless clients achieve self-sufficiency. The city has seen a dramatic drop in the number of homeless thanks to the human connections made and the new community focus on finding resources for housing. While Portland and Multnomah County are working together on a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness, Project Homeless Connect makes you, a key part of the solution. For more information, you can go to Portland Online, that's one word, portlandonline.com /BHCD/index. And it should come up. There's a lot more to that. But once you go to that part, you should be able to click on it, or you can go to portlandonline.com, and in the left-hand column, there's a search space, and just type in there, Project Homeless Connect.
Oh,
I got a little bit more now.
Okay. Sorry.
I lost my train. It's derailed. Crash. Here we go. This project can make real change in the lives of people who need help, but nothing can change without you being there. Volunteers are needed, both individuals and company, as well as donations of in-kind resources, expertise, and money. You can make the difference in another person's life by donating or volunteering your help. So, if you want more information, you can go to www.portlandhomelessconnect.com. That's one word. And at that website, you can also volunteer. Okay.
And is there a phone number?
No, I don't have a phone number.
I have a phone number.
Go. Shoot it. Okay. Hit it. I'm going to write it down on this, too.
For a phone number, you may contact... I have a phone number. I mean, you may contact Kathleen Gardipe, Gardipee. Her number is 503-823-3603.
Great. You know, this is really thrilling because one of the projects that I'm working on with my job is a homeless day center.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been working for a couple of years to make this a reality, going through various stages of community organizing to put it together. And we're about to realize our dream on this, and we'll be opening up for, we expect to do graduated opening, because you get stuff, but you don't want to wait until you have everything together to get stuff. But we're going to open up in January.
Excellent.
Yeah. No location yet. We got to finish with the paperwork. Make sure that we have our contract in place.
Certainly.
And then once we do that, then we can announce the name of the place, and we can also have people come in. And one of the wonderful things about this is that it's a grassroots effort started by community organizations and people that live in the community. And there is a breakfast that occurs at one of the community partners on Monday mornings, and what we did is we interviewed and surveyed a lot of the people who patronize it, who are homeless. What do you need? What do you want? And most of the folks said, well, we need some place that we could at least take a shower, wash your clothes, get phone calls for jobs, get mail, get email, mm-hmm. stuff as that. So we took that into consideration and started working to that end.
Sounds like an excellent project, and hopefully you'll be able to share more.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. We had a great cleanup working with folks from the community and community service volunteers. But the phone number, again, for more information is 503-823-3603. That's 3603. And what's your...
As many of you are aware, the Congress is trying to decide on a budget. There is a national movement to call the Congress to do the right thing. The budget is a moral document. This week is a National Week of Prayer and Action to impact the appropriation budget currently under consideration by Congress. Nationally, communities will gather in places throughout the nation to petition their servants to make sure they do the correct thing in terms of making sure that those who need services will be served. People who care will gather around the country to ask their congressional representatives to protect the vital public services that are proposed for cuts. This Wednesday at December 14th at 2005 at 12 noon in Portland at the World Trade Center outside of Senator Smith's office, people will gather to witness the prayer for a vigil for Congress to do the correct thing, to make sure that the appropriations budget makes sure that those who are least fortunate will be served. In this holiday season, it is appropriate to make sure that those who are among the least of these will be served. So again, this will be a vigil and action that will take place this Wednesday, December 14th at 12 noon at the World Trade Center in downtown Portland. I think that's 2nd and Salmon.
Okay, yeah. Across from the Thomas Hall Waterfront Park. Kind of across from
Kind of across, yeah.
Across the street and down a little bit. And then finally, one more goodie here, a community event. You all, especially folks that live within the Northeast community area, are cordially invited to the 7th annual Edna Robinson and Sharon McCormick Holiday Celebration. There'll be refreshments, entertainment, toys for the kids, picture with Santa, gifts for children ages 10 and under. Children must be accompanied by a parent to attend. It takes place this coming Saturday, December 17th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Salvation Army. This is an opportunity for people who might be low income and concerned and struggling for the holidays to get some fellowship, some fun, and some support. If you've got some questions, you want some more information, you can call 503-493-3925. And again, this takes place at the Moore Street Salvation Army Street Corps and Community Center, located at 5335 North Williams. Great opportunity to get together. A lot of folks who might be struggling for the holidays find a lot of fun, entertainment there for the kids. I think maybe past 3 years I've had a chance to be involved, and it's a great opportunity. When I was doing AmeriCorps, we were also involved. And as part of that celebration, on Monday, December 19th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., low-income members of our community can come and get professional holiday haircuts free. First come, first served, same place. Moore Street Community Center, 5335 North Williams.
Those are some excellent activities and programs you may participate in. So if you have any questions or want some more information, you may certainly call the front desk here after 9 a.m. for more information. We hope all of you may participate in those events which you think are useful and helpful for your community.
All right.
Let me remind you that you are listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Joining us at the 8 o'clock hour will be an expert on China who will talk about the role of China in the world economy and what is happening in the world today. So join us as we speak to our guests. And who will be our guests?
Oh, yeah. That's what I get for having my nose buried in some notes trying to read some goodies here. His name is Michael Zelenziger. Did I say that right? Zelenziger. I think I got it right.
It is close enough. And certainly
okay.
By the time we get Michael on the phone, we'll have
his
name.
We'll be aptly schooled.
As Celeste adjusts her chair.
I'm trying. It's defying me. I should have just stuck with my notes.
She's sinking. She's moving.
Hey, I like these new chairs, though. I'm not going to argue. You know, I can actually get them so my feet can touch the ground.
Great.
Yeah, I'm not going to complain at all. Well, in the meantime, you know, I picked up another article in addition to the reading that we had. And we were talking about the holiday season and China's role in the world economy. And I do intend to talk with our guests a little bit about this, but it's really interesting about how, despite a nation's role, quote-unquote legitimate role in the world economy, they still find ways to both make sales and to impact the world economy. Friday, December 9th, Marketplace section and that's with the technology, health, media, marketing, yada, yada, of the Wall Street Journal. There's an article here that was really interesting, given the way a lot of consumer goods are packaged to us, given the fact that, again, like I said, a lot of countries and groups managed to enter the underground economy. This was really interesting because it talked about counterfeit for Christmas, gift givers tapping a new source as travel to China eases and knockoff in quality improves. So what they have is Santa Claus, you know, in various states of bling here, and some of the bling he's carrying, and I'll define bling in context here, or it looks like Burberry plaid shirt. Louis Vuitton knockoff, you know, some Tiffany knockoff, some watches, some golf clubs, some Yves Saint Laurent knockoffs. And it's really funny because the whole concept behind this article is the fact that now people can get some bootleg bounty. And they can get it in good shape, looks good, good quality from China. Those folks who do spend money on pricey gifts are now undermining the higher end of the economy by flying to China or going online to the internet or various other means, ordering goods that you might spend thousands of dollars for and getting them sometimes for hundreds of dollars instead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an interesting side, if you will, in that for all of the ideas of how easing trade restrictions is supposed to benefit a country, benefit a people, who it actually benefits. Does it benefit just the fat cats and oppressive regimes? Does it actually benefit the working class and the community? What does it do to the economy here in the States or in other parts of the world? They still find a way to rise to the surface and become a world player.
Exactly. The article is in the December 9th edition of the Wall Street Journal, and the author of the article?
Mi Fong.
Mi Fong.
Mm-hmm. It's called Counterfeit for Christmas, if you want to pick it up and read it.
Well, certainly that's an important issue, and hopefully people will pick it up, and I assume that if they use a search engine, they'll be able to find that on the internet somewhere.
Yeah, the author's name is spelled M-E-I, and then last name is F-O-N-G, and you could probably Google it. I don't know how much of the Wall Street Journal they have as subscription only. Some sites, you know, you can only log into so much of it. But I like to peruse it when I get the opportunity to do it for free.
Okay.
Because sometimes you follow where the money is and you can find some interesting articles. And I, you know, I'm not going to say that it's an end-all, be-all for news, but it is interesting to find out what kind of news that the money market folks choose to put out. So we're looking for the high sign here from our engineer as to whether he is making the call.
And you are in the process of making the call.
He's getting the phone number so that he can make the call so that we can have our guest.
Well, as you know, as an introduction to our guest, the President of the United States, as presidents often do,
mm-hmm.
fled the country when his popularity went down.
Fled the country. You say that as if this is the first time this president has fled any situation to the relative security of his sanctum sanctorum. You act like this is the first time he's gone on vacation.
No. He wasn't on vacation as such. Usually that's Texas.
Yeah.
And what, 6, 7, 8 weeks in the summer in July and August. But recently he took a journey to look at our trading and political allies.
Oh, yes.
And he went to China recently.
It was not the reception he expected.
Well, he said, and I quote, "China is a big, growing, strong country, and it's very important for me to maintain a good working relationship with the leadership here."
That almost sounds to the point.
It does almost sound to the point. I was just amazed by the first sentence, though. It's as if someone just pointed him out that this China exists, and he noted China is a big,
big country.
Growing, strong country.
Strong country.
But
God bless that man. Somebody needs to.
But as his recent visit, yeah, someone does. As President Bush's recent trip visit to China demonstrates, it's time for not only the president, but for the world to acknowledge China's position and potential, meriting both caution and celebration on both sides of the Pacific. Sino-U.S. relations exist in a delicate balance of supply, demand, and dependency. While some analysts are wary of the trade, economic, and military power building in the so-called Red East, although are hopeful that China's so-called peaceful rise will bring about positive advancement in global relations, security, and economics. Whether wary or hopeful, China experts all agree now is the time to bridge building. And so among the questions we will ask our guests today is, how do we ensure a future of mutual peace and prosperity with the so-called walking dragon? It is also should be noted that the WTO is meeting in Hong Kong, so it's appropriate
as we speak.
So it is appropriate for us to talk about Asia in general and China specifically, about its role in the world economy and also how it impacts the U.S. economy and also the growing cry across the world for democracy and human rights.
Well, as we are getting ready to get to our guest, I'm going to read a little bit of an article by our guest that kind of ties into my article that I mentioned from the Wall Street Journal regarding counterfeit for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I mentioned was how everyday Americans are making choices to purchase goods made in China. Now, we talk a lot about the trade deficit that America has with China because we're buying a lot more goods from them than we're selling them. But when I say that, I'm thinking in terms of some of your top name businesses or designers or whatever that are like Ralph Lauren, for example, or Liz Claiborne or others. I know. I'm not saying anybody ought to buy them. I'm just stating facts here. Because remember, I was talking about
knockoffs. And they're all well-known. So
yeah. It's not like we're out there spending our hard-earned sweat money, you know, on it. But the fact is that they choose to go over there where they can get these goods made cheaper. The fascinating thing is they're in competition with Chinese-made goods, not from their companies, but like I said, the knockoffs. So when we talk about the goods we buy or the fact that choices are being made which will drive that deficit, some of those choices are made at a much lower level than we expect. When you're walking on the streets of New York and you pick up that knockoff Gucci bag, maybe you're part of that trade deficit. Okay, well, without further ado.
Joining us this morning is our guest, Michael Zunglinger, who is the visiting scholar at the Institute of East Asian Studies, University of California, Berkeley. As a Tokyo-based bureau chief for Knight Rider newspaper for 7 years, he has traveled and has written extensively about social, economic, and political trends in China, Korea, Japan, and South Asia. He's a 1995 Pulitzer Prize finalist in international reporting. He wrote a series describing the efforts of overseas Chinese to propel the modernization of China. So we thank you so much this morning for joining us, and help us with the correct pronunciation of your last name, sir.
Easier than you think. It's Zunglinger.
Zunglinger. Okay, now we've got it.
Good.
Well, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I guess we'll start out with some basic questions here. First and foremost, why should America be concerned with trade with China?
Well, I only caught the last part of what you were saying. Our economic relationship along with China is a very complex one, one that's both cooperative and competitive. Cooperative in the sense that anytime your listeners go into whether it's you know, Walmart or Macy's or almost any retail store, a significant amount of the price they're paying for a lot for toys, for instance, for Christmas, is lower than it otherwise might be because so much of it is now made in China. So there's both good news and bad news. If you're a toy worker who used to work in New Hampshire, for instance, making toys, or in South Carolina, and you lost your job, you're unhappy. If you're a consumer who's buying gifts for Christmas and find that your $100 goes a whole lot further this year than it might have 5 years ago, that's also because of China. So that's just one part of the issue. The second thing is we talk a lot about the trade deficit. There are a lot of American firms who think they're going to make money in the future in the Chinese domestic market. The more China grows, the thinking goes, the more it acts somewhat like a vacuum cleaner, sucking up a lot of the services, a lot of the software, a lot of the high-end stuff that we Americans produce. Now, on the competitive side, we saw earlier this year when the Chinese National Oil Exploration Company tried to buy up Unocal, which is based in Southern California, which doesn't have a whole lot of oil per se. It's more of a retailer, but still, it needs oil, and so it's competing with the United States for oil around the world. And so, arguably, when our gas prices go up, as they really spiked up this summer, at least a small part of that is our competition with Chinese drivers, because the Chinese are suddenly driving a lot more automobiles than they used to. You used to go to Beijing; it was a bicycle society. Now they're freeways and traffic jams like ours.
Well, that's kind of disheartening.
Well, we want them, and I don't mean just Americans.
Right.
The Chinese themselves want automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
GM wants to sell them automobiles. So does Toyota, and so does Renault.
Mm-hmm.
The whole world realizes
Everybody.
China is a great growth market going forward, and they're very eager to please. But the Chinese themselves are also building their own cars, which someday may be competitive with Americans. Now, it's easy for your listeners to say, the Chinese, they'll never build a car. But, you know, that's what they used to say about Japanese. Oh, the Japanese will never build a car that we'd want to drive. And, of course, look at all the Toyotas and probably your own company parking lot out there in Portland. The point is, you know, technology and competition is such that a competitor who seems not in the game, if he's diligent, if he works hard, if he spends a decade or so getting the fine points right, sooner or later he's going to be competitive with guys who aren't moving forward themselves. You know, General Motors and Ford are in some bit of competitive difficulty today because they invested a lot of money in SUVs and big trucks, thinking that was a quick way to profits without really investing in hybrid technology the way Toyota did. So now all of a sudden, with oil prices higher, it's catch-up. This is a competitive world out there, and I think what's important about China is to recognize it's not a static world. It's changing all the time. And the new player on the block, the guy who's rising very quickly, is China. And that matters because their growth can be good for the world, although it causes stresses, but it also creates opportunities. But the way they come into the world has to be managed. And the question is, are they going to play by the rules that you and I play by?
And in terms of describing those rules that you and I play by, should we consider China an economic partner or an economic competitor?
Or both.
Well, I think, you know, this is a constant. Well, the question of rules should relate to any country. And by rules, I mean governance. I mean, is it legal to simply copyright somebody's software or somebody's movie? Now, we would say no. But in China, it's very easy to walk down the street one block from the American embassy and pick up a pirated copy of last week's big hit movie. I'm sure whatever movie was out 2 weeks ago was already available in China. When Windows 95 was still not yet public, I could get a copy of it in Beijing, and it worked perfectly well, and I paid $2 for it. Now, at the time, I justified to myself, I'm doing this as a journalist to see if it really works.
Research.
But the reality is when I got home, it was like, well, should I spend $200 and send it to Redmond for the software, or should I use the Chinese copy? Because you know what? In the digital world, everything works exactly the same. China can be an angry competitor if we want it to be, and it can be a collaborator if we want it to be. The Bush administration isn't clear which. To give you an example, before 9/11, the Bush administration said, the Clinton people were way too cozy with China. We think Chinese are strategic challengers, and we want to build up our military because we're worried about the Chinese. After September 11th, the Bush people said, you know, we really need Beijing's help if we're going to contain the spread of international terrorism. And suddenly the Chinese became very supportive of a lot of the American initiatives, especially in Afghanistan. they've been a little less, shall we say, enthusiastic about Iraq, but I don't want to get into Middle East politics at the moment. Point is, in a shrinking world, you have a country of 1.2 billion people that's hard-pressed not to grow at 9% a year. Mm. Your neighbors and the rest of the world are going to notice. And therefore, we have to sort of accept that China wants to fulfill its own destiny, whatever that may be, and we have to kind of acknowledge that that's an issue in the world, and we have to figure out how we're going to live with them. In terms of governance, you know, civil society, rule of law, do they exist in China? The answer is not really. The Chinese, after all, were a socialist country, and they put economic development ahead of democratic reforms. How long that can continue is an issue that we'll have to see being addressed. There's already tension now in China over those subjects.
Well, you mentioned in terms of China and describing China's economy and China's political system. How would you describe it? Is it a socialist economy or is it not?
It's a socialist economy with Chinese characteristics, which means it's whatever the Chinese Politburo says it is. Once upon a time, every factory, every store, every outlet was owned by the party. The entire economy was full of state, what we called state-owned enterprises, SOEs, because the party decided how many shirts were going to be produced, how much coal was going to be mined, how many toothbrushes were going to be made, and that's how the economy worked. And as we learned in the 70s, the economy didn't work so well. And it was up to the reformers led by Deng Xiaoping to go to South China and say, black cat, white cat, I don't care as long as it hunts mice. Translation, we need to shuck off this legacy of communism that no longer works and create an entrepreneurial capitalistic system so that we can feed our people, so that we can grow and grow our economy. And suddenly, what began in Shenzhen as an experiment has taken off around the country. Now you have lots of entrepreneurs, a vast part of the economy that's in private hands. China has joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which is a way of the Chinese saying, we want to bring the outside world into China. We want foreign investment in this country. It's one of the real differences, if you look back, between China's growth and Japan's growth. We all recognize now that Japan's an incredibly wealthy, rich country. It's competitive with us in lots of technology fields and automobiles. But the Japanese economy is almost completely closed to outside investment.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese take more foreign investment in 1 year than the Japanese have taken cumulatively over the last 30, because the Japanese say, we basically don't want foreigners in our system.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese approach is different. The Chinese say, we are almost 2 billion people. We need the outside world's help. We need to learn from the outside world. So we want to bring in your best factories, your best chip makers, your best car makers, because not only can you be a platform for your exports to other Asian countries, for instance, but in a vast majority of the time, a lot of what is being produced in China is being consumed in China.
Mm-hmm.
After all, we suddenly have a big middle class in China. You think about it. In a country so big, if just 10% of the Chinese economy is middle class, that's two-thirds the population of the United States. That's 180 million people. That's a lot of people who want to buy upscale cars and designer jeans and Louis Vuitton handbags. And the foreign companies recognize that. So some companies are there just to export, but a lot of companies are there also to produce for the local market.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge. In the Willamette Valley, it's 100.7, and on the web, kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Today, our guest is Michael Zelenziger, and we're talking...
There you go. It's not so hard the second time.
It just flows. Mellifluous.
Off the tongue, right? Flows off the tongue.
And if folks would like to flow off the tongue with us today with our guests, 503-231-8187. And you have an opportunity to talk about China's economy and the world economy, U.S. economy, how it all impacts us. And we'll go to our caller who's been waiting. Good morning.
Yes, hello, sir, Michael. I've been sensing something for a while. I don't have anything organized or any backup. And it's I've been sensing, I know the world's a lot more complex than I'm aware of, but I've been sensing for some time there's some kind of organized energy. I don't know whether it's Japan, China, Saudi Arabia, Russia, or with each other or with other countries, organized to to make our country into a third world country or whatever, by infiltrating or influencing our Senate and House of Representatives, and might possibly even be behind the Bush government or support of it. So I'm just going to put that out. It's not complex. It's not. And see what I'll listen to your thinking on it. Okay.
I think the caller's asking me whether I think Congress is being run by a bunch of spies from abroad. I actually don't think that. I may disagree with what's going on in the American Congress, but a lot of the Congress is being run by people who are clearly very nationalistic and very supportive of a certain kind of, especially right policy in the United States. We've never seen a Congress that's been more unified around one party and one sort of set of ideologies, to the point where the Democrats and most opposition are pretty marginalized. So I don't know that that's really a factor. I want to bring up one other connection, if it's okay, between the U.S. and China that your listeners may not appreciate. You know, if you look at the economic numbers in the western states, in Oregon, in Washington, California, and Idaho, the one thing that's been really leading the economy has been housing and construction.
Yes.
And that's basically related to China. And that's because, you know, we have an enormous trade deficit as well as a budget deficit. In other words, we buy more from abroad than we ship them, but we're also spending more as a country out of our national checkbook than we're bringing in revenue. Now, if you or I to go that, we have to go to bankruptcy court, but the American government can just run debt.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys, the people who have to buy those debts are overseas. And the people who are buying most of our debts are China and Japan. And you say to yourself, well, why are they doing that? In the case of China and Japan, in both cases, they need to keep the American consumer shopping because it's the lower prices and the lower mortgage rates which keep us buying houses, which keep us going to the big department stores to buy our new refrigerators and flat panel TV sets. Without the growth of the American consumer spending, China doesn't grow at 9% a year. If China doesn't grow at 9% a year, people in China don't have jobs. If people in China don't have jobs, they get pretty unhappy, and before you know it, you have revolution on your hands, which is not what the Central Committee has in mind. It would rather spend its huge surplus on our treasury bills than it would to at least brook the prospects of some internal revolt. So we have this very strange codependency where we keep running deficits, we keep spending more than we earn, and the rest of the world keeps telling us like they would to a drunk, handing them a bottle and say, hey, keep on drinking. So at some point, these bills will come due.
Yes.
Because at some point, the Chinese are going to say, you know, we want the American economy to be strong, but we want to make sure we get our money paid back, too. It's time for us to move some of our debt purchases to the euro, for instance, buy up the French and the German debt instead. And that would cause an immediate spike upwards in American interest rates, and house mortgage prices would go way up. So we have a lot of issues on the plate with China, and it's very difficult to disentangle one from the other.
We're speaking this morning with Michael Zielinski of the Institute of East Asian Studies. We're speaking about China. Among the topics we hope to talk about this morning is China's role within the WTO, its relationship with the United States, and its economic and political economy. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. Our numbers are 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning. Turn your radio down. Hello? Okay, we'll call back, caller. We've got some technical issues here.
Recently, the president went to China. What was his reason for going, and what is your view of his mission there?
Well, the president makes an annual Asian trip. There's a meeting usually held in Asia called the APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group. People have often said it's four nouns still looking for a verb. It's a way for the Asian countries to meet every year and talk about various security, trade, economic issues. The United States is a player in APEC, so the president has this opportunity every fall to go over there. He visited China. He lectured the Chinese about freedom, but only did it from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Went to China to meet with Hu Jintao, but, you know, it's been clear the last couple times that when the Chinese and the Americans meet, they don't have a lot to talk about. President Bush tends to, we all know from some of the books that have been written about the internal workings of the White House, tends to operate from his instincts, from his gut, and one has a sense that he doesn't really like the Chinese. He doesn't really trust the Chinese. There are a lot of people in his administration who believe that the Chinese are going to be a military threat going mm-hmm. forward, and that's why we should keep building up our military, even separate from the war on terrorism. So although there are issues on the plate like intellectual property rights, like freeing up of dissidents, like the rights of non-government organizations, not to mention the economic relationship, there wasn't really a lot of substance in the conversation. Bush went on a bicycle ride in Beijing. He went to a church, which was interesting because he went to an officially sanctioned church,
yeah.
of which there are only a few, causing a lot of civil libertarians to wonder whether he wasn't, in effect, endorsing the fact that the state in China tells you which churches you can go to and which churches you can't. We know there are thousands of underground churches in China. And one bad thing, often when a president goes to China, the State Department has given the Chinese government in advance mm-hmm. a list of political prisoners and dissidents they'd like to have released.
Uh-huh.
And as a goodwill gesture, some of these people are released when the president comes. This time, nobody got released, which was kind of a sign that perhaps Bush's clout isn't what he'd hope it would be with the Chinese. The Chinese respect the United States, but they also are sort of telling the world, you know, we can operate pretty well in Asia without you. And there's reason to believe that the United States is becoming essentially marginalized in parts of Asia, Korea being the best example. Korea is China's neighbor. We fought a war for the South Koreans. It's still not, there's still no peace treaty between North and South Korea. You walk the streets in Seoul today, and a lot of people will tell you they think George Bush is more dangerous to the world than Kim Jong-il, the mm-hmm. leader of North Korea. And that creates a lot of pressure on the U.S.-Korean alliance, which in turn strengthens, in a sense, China's ability to integrate itself into the rest of Asia. And so one of the things I argue in Shutting Out the Sun, my new book, is that what's going to happen in Asia going forward is that we may have the United States and Japan on one side on the periphery of Asia and China and Korea integrating the rest of the region. Mm-hmm. Because if you go to places like Malaysia or Indonesia, the majority of that economy is already run by Chinese nationals, mm-hmm. by Malaysian Chinese or Indonesian Chinese who've lived there for many, many decades, but of course share ethnic roots and heritage with mainland China. Over time, the Chinese seem able to stitch together a real network of tributaries, if you like, in mm-hmm. Asia, and the United States could well be on the outside looking in, which is probably not a prospect we think so highly of.
In terms of other nations outside of the Asian community,
right?
What's China's relationship like, and how is it looking? How's it jockeying for position?
It's a very good question, and the Chinese are very strategic. 15 years ago, the Chinese did not really have a major diplomatic presence.
Mm-hmm.
They were still getting out of their communist straitjacket, if you will. They hadn't become worldly in the ways of diplomacy and the ways of the world. Now the Chinese realize they are the coming power. They have growing international clout. They have a lot more money than they used to. They have enormous trade surpluses and, therefore, lots of foreign reserves in their checkbook. You know, we don't like President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, right? We, i.e. the Bush administration,
right.
He's a dangerous leftist,
uh-huh.
and he should be contained. Well, Hu Jintao goes to Venezuela because he wants oil.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chinese realize, hey, we want oil. It doesn't matter to us whether it comes from Saudi Arabia or from Venezuela or from Sudan. And in fact, the Chinese are now going to some of our, shall we say, least desirable other nations in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not talk about Venezuela, but certainly in Africa, there are certain countries that could use some governance themselves. And they'll make deals because they are a hungry, growing country that is consuming more resources, that needs more oil and gas, and will make deals with neighbors that we might not make. So they are becoming something of a counterbalance to American foreign policy in certain parts of the world. And that's, I don't think it's disturbing particularly. I think we need to realize that that's the way the world works, that countries tend to act in their self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese realize they're going to need more oil and gas in the future. You know, we didn't allow the Chinese to buy Unocal, so they went off and bought Petrokazakh in Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm.
So a deal is a deal, so to speak. And if they can't get oil in America, they may well buy up oil sands in Canada. Because to a lot of other countries, if your check's as good as the next guy's, they'll do a deal with you. And why shouldn't we? We're the ones actually who preach the free market. So the Chinese were playing by free market rules, but we say not in our country. Thank you.
But what we seem to be ignoring is the fact that they're building up a substantial economic bloc, if not a political bloc, that we may not be able to penetrate.
That's correct. Of course, that was always our playbook.
We were the ones who were building
up an economic and trade bloc, and we were the ones who were, look what we did in Europe.
Yes.
Now,
mm-hmm.
we're the ones who helped create NATO, which has now evolved into the European Union. You know, we've been the integrating power. We've been the one who wanted to be multinational until quite recently. Mm-hmm. It's only really in the past administration where we had quite a significant turn from the previous philosophy of international, nation building and building of multilateral organizations, that we've kind of turned deaf ear to how the rest of the world thinks about us. Mm-hmm. And that has real consequences. The Chinese recognize that compared to a decade ago, not everybody mm-hmm. thinks of the United States as going into all opportunities with clean hands and with the best of intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese are able to take advantage of that.
Actually, very few, if anybody, if any country thinks that. Mm-hmm.
There was a day,
Right, there was a day.
To do with the United States, because we were the sunny optimists who gave everybody a fair shake.
Mm-hmm. Gave everybody a fair shake and came to their aid.
That's right.
Without meddling so much.
That's right.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 in the city. This is More Talk Radio here. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can do so by dialing 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm delighted you have Mr. Zelenziger on. I watched him on McNeil Lehrer for a long time and
yes.
read him in the San Jose paper, I believe, when he was in Tokyo.
That's right. Thank you very much.
I have a question. You've talked about how China's getting increasingly like the United States in some ways. I wonder if you could speak to how their educational system is functioning. I know there was a time back in the dark ages when I was in high school that they sent the best and brightest to college in the United States. How does that play now?
That's a great question. First of all, thank you for the question. We see a lot of now high graduate students coming to the United States, whereas we see lots of Americans going to China for opportunities to teach the Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
I have a friend in Paris who's just helping open a business school of Europeans and Chinese to teach the Chinese the best Western-style management skills
mm-hmm.
To get them up to the same speed as somebody who would be working at, Kellogg or GM or Tektronix. We have the other thing that happens in China is with so many people, with probably, 12 million 11th grade students every year in China, maybe even more than that, probably 30 million.
Mm-hmm.
If you set, think about it, you take 30 million people and you set your filters and your screens high enough, the top 2,000 of those kids are going to be as good as any top 2,000 students in the United States. And what you're seeing is those students are now taking the exams and going to the Chinese universities like Beidou or Tsinghua for their undergraduate education, and then coming to places like Berkeley and Stanford and the University of Washington and MIT for their graduate training. I was recently at a meeting with the dean of the engineering school at Berkeley who said, we know that 3,000 fabulous engineers are going to the United States from China next year, and I want to get the top 200. The other thing that's true is if you go to medical research labs at universities around the country, they would shut their doors tomorrow if there weren't enough Chinese graduate students, because they are the ones who are running these labs.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's happened after 9/11 is that we, the United States, cracked down on who could get a visa. And so now it's very, very time-consuming to get a visa to travel to the U.S. from places like China. And that's put a crimp on the ability of Chinese to go back and forth. Now, we could argue that, oh, my God, this is a great drain of the intellectual property of the United States. But if we've learned anything in the Internet age, it's that information wants to be free. And it's very difficult to contain somebody's knowledge in one company or in one firm or in one industry. One of the things that made Silicon Valley so great is that engineers going from company to company and feeling no compunction about discussing their ideas as they went from Intel to AMD to a startup. Well, that entrepreneurial culture is also beginning to take off in China. The graduate students who used to go from Tsinghua to Berkeley or Stanford to a software company or a chip maker in Silicon Valley or in Portland for that matter, that used to be the end of the story. They used to just stay there and work at these American companies. now, increasingly, after 2 or 3 or 5 years, these guys are saying, you know what? Now that I understand this entrepreneurial thing, I'm going to start my new company, but it's going to be in China. I met a guy recently who has pioneered some device to allow you to pay all your bills on your cell phone, mm-hmm. which may not sound like a big deal to Americans, but understand that in China, cell phone penetration is even bigger than it is here, and everybody has a cell phone. The idea is instead of having like a PayPal account on your PC, which is what you have here now to pay your online bills, you do it out of your telephone. And he's been created this business that's a huge hit in China. And if you ask him about how many people he has, though, I have a 75-person company, but 73 of them are in China. Only 2 of them are here because that's where his opportunity is going to be. So that's a real change in the profile of our sort of economic and educational partnership with China.
I have one more quick question for you.
Yes.
You might have answered this while I was getting my coffee, but is this what your book is about? You mentioned you have a book.
No, my book, thank you. My book's actually more about Japan. We used to, especially out here on the West Coast, it was true in certainly Seattle when I lived there and in California as well, we used to think that the Japanese were going to run the world. After all, they had bought up Rockefeller Center and they had bought up Pebble Beach. And they were writing books about how the Japanese had all the answers. My book is called Shutting Out the Sun. It'll be published next September by Nantelis Doubleday. And it explains what happened to this country that we thought was going to run the world, which went through an economic crisis in 1990 and really hasn't been heard from since. It's now 2005, and Japan has been in recession for most of the past 15 years, and yet there's been no political revolution. In fact, there are lots of social disorders. Why is it that one of the wealthiest countries in the world has a very high suicide rate? Why does it have one of the lowest birth rates in the world? Because its women don't want to have children. And why are there more than 1 million young adults between the ages of 18 and 40 who shut themselves in their rooms and never come out for years at a time?
Wow.
So that's what the book's about.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you for your call.
We're speaking this morning with Michael Zelenziger of the Institute for Asian Studies.
East Asian Studies.
East Asian Studies. One thing that, when the last caller was questioning you, one thing that occurred to me is it would be helpful if you gave some sort of historical context in terms of the U.S. relationship with China. I think oftentimes we have a very short memory span, and if we just go back to, say, the beginning of the 20th century in terms of some of our immigration policies, we both often had this maybe more hate than love relationship with China.
Well, to go back to China in history, you should really go back to the Opium War, if you think about it. You know,
mm-hmm.
why did Britain have Hong Kong until 1997? Because Britain basically used a drug cartel to open up China. China was like Japan. China didn't want to be open to the West. China said, we don't need you smelly, long-nosed barbarians. We are the great Middle Kingdom, and we're not interested in trade or interchange with the world. And the British didn't like that, and the Opium War succeeded in opening up a number of treaty ports to countries like Germany, the United States, and Britain. And that's how the British got Hong Kong and how the Portuguese got Macau. So for many years, that's the beginning of the relationship, a sense of being disadvantaged by the West, taken advantage of by the West. Then in the 40s, the U.S. and China carved a very strong positive relationship, being antagonistic to China. Remember that before Pearl Harbor, the Japanese had invaded mainland China, and they were running mainland China. And if you go get the old classic movie, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, which is about Jimmy Doolittle's raid on firebombing of Tokyo, all those planes landed in China, and we depended on the Chinese to get our soldiers home. So there was a traditional sense, in fact, in the movie, which I just saw recently, Van Johnson, who's been injured in this terrible plane crash, tells the Chinese, of course I'll be back after the war because you people are just like us. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a sense of the Chinese and Americans are similar and share similar continental fates. And besides, we both successfully defeated the Japanese in war. What happened after that, of course, was the 1949 revolution, Mao Zedong, unseated a very corrupt Kuomintang government, and the KMT all fled to Taiwan, and that's why we have the conflict today between mainland China and Taiwan. As long as China was communist, we didn't want to deal with it. After all, we had a Cold War. We were containing communism all over the world, and for us, Chinese communism, Russian communism, it didn't really matter. It was communism.
Mm-hmm.
It was only when Nixon went to China in 1972 that we decided we should begin a pragmatic relationship with the Chinese, acknowledge that there was only one China and Beijing was its capital. And since the mid-70s, our relationships with the Chinese have warmed. What we didn't expect to happen quite so soon was that by the early 1980s, the Chinese would all but abandon state socialism in favor of getting up the capitalist road. When you go to China and talk to Chinese, they say, you know, we're a great people, full of incredibly skilled people, and we lost an entire generation and a half because of this stupid thing called communism, this misadventure that didn't work, that, you know, caused national starvation. And we are eager to catch up and become this great power. So the economic ties, as we started this conversation, the economic ties between these countries have gotten stronger over the past 15 years. But this complicates the political side, not only in the battle for resources, but as I said before, there are some people in Washington who believe that the Chinese military will someday be a threat to the United States, and that we need an enemy, really, even separate from terrorism, we need a state enemy to focus our attention. Donald Rumsfeld frequently speaks about what he believes to be the lack of transparency in China. In other words, the Chinese are spending money on their army, and we don't know what they're spending it on, and this is potentially dangerous. So, on the one hand, there's always a battle in America between those who believe that China and the United States share strategic complementary abilities to be allies, and those who believe that China over time will become an incredible strategic competitor of the United States. So, there's kind of a yin and yang in the relationship. It depends in part on the president. It depends in part on the economy. Now, these relationships go back and forth. My argument is, if you make China an enemy, it will become an enemy. But if you tell the Chinese, we can work with you, we can be friends, and here are the limits, here's what we expect, then a lot of the time the Chinese will understand that. They are also very pragmatic. The point is to be focused, to be strategic, and to be consistent. And unfortunately, between administrations and sometimes even in administrations, we aren't always that consistent.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, just to be really kind of simplistic about it, our concern ought to be a little less about the military and looking at issues around the economic and the and within the economic relationship, things like you said earlier, intellectual ownership, property ownership.
Right.
Those seem to be more of a concern, because that, along with the fact that they're holding a lot of our notes, so to speak, speaks a lot more to the control that they have over us that military may not ever bring. I mean,
right.
it's a more thorough infiltration of our culture, if you will.
Right. Well, it's also infiltrated our culture in other ways. You know, there are plenty of people in Portland who go to Tai Chi lessons or go to drink unusual teas, or are into martial arts, or thought Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was a really cool movie. There is, in a sense, another part of the Chinese relationship, and that's cultural.
Yes.
There are lots of people now interested in Buddhism. I have a friend who did a show on Taoism at the Asian Art Museum, and she said to me, you know, when I researched this show, it made me realize... the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco, made me realize how much the cultural connections between the U.S. and China have really exploded. We have a lot of interest in the Chinese way of looking at the world because it's different than our own. The Chinese are a much older society than our own. So you can, at a certain level, not admire their accomplishments over the centuries. It's a great nation. And it's going to continue to tell people, you know, one of the issues is, from what perspective do you look at things? For instance, we didn't really talk yet about things like the pollution problem or the global warming problem.
Right.
But something like 10% of the smog that shows up in Southern California, and I would assume in Portland as well, comes actually from Chinese coal-fired power plants. So the Chinese are affecting our day-to-day life. Now, we can attack them for that, or we can say, hey, you know, we really need to help you figure out how to clean up your act as you move forward. The Chinese are growing so quickly, they need more and more electricity. They need more power. We have to teach them how to get it. They also have one of the least efficient energy systems in the world. So we need to help the Chinese figure out how to get more efficient in their production of electricity for their people. We can't tell them, no, you can't have electricity. We can't tell them, no, you can't have oil. That's kind of illegal. But we can say, let's help you get up the slope. Now, the Chinese, for their part, say, well, wait a minute. You, the United States, have about 1.5% of the world's population, but you consume like 7% of the world's energy resources. Is that fair to the rest of us?
Mm-hmm.
When are you going to slow down? So these are, you know, the truth always depends to some extent on where you start looking at it from. What's your perspective? And the Chinese have a legitimate worldview all their own, and sometimes my argument to other Americans is, it doesn't matter whether you think they're right or wrong. Understand where they are coming from, and at least you can have a better sense of the issue.
Well, you summed it up, too, when you said they have a legitimate right. Just because we've claimed preeminence doesn't mean that we deserve preeminence. You're listening to More Talk Radio. We have a couple of folks who have been holding online, and we'll go to our guest. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, Michael, when you were talking a little earlier about, you know, why China might be carrying some of our notes, and then you mentioned the 9/11 when the towers were hit. Who picked up all the debris from those towers after they went down? Where was it shipped to? That would probably be a bigger reason in my mind why China's holding our notes than any other. What's your opinion?
I'm not sure I follow the question. You're saying that, I don't know. I was living in Tokyo in 9/11. I don't know who picked up the...
Well, it was reported that a Chinese company basically came in and picked up all the debris before the forensic people could get in to take a look at the structure of the steel, the concrete, everything from the two towers that came crashing to the ground. I was just wondering, do you see a correlation between the Chinese being involved right after 9/11 with the removal of those pieces of evidence, as it were, and their participation as far as carrying the notes for the United States now?
No, I don't see any connection at all.
Okay.
I mean, the Chinese have made some very practical economic decisions. First of all, the great thing about American debt is that nobody in the world, whether it's Swiss bankers or Russians or Chinese, believe at the end of the day the Americans are going to default on their payments. We have another advantage, by the way. We can keep printing up dollars to pay off our notes, so that gives us some advantage over other countries.
Without having to have them backed by the gold standard.
That's right. We have no longer have a gold. We can devalue our currency, so to speak, in order to pay off our debts if we come to that. That's the worst-case scenario that some people always worry about. That's why there are people out there who, the same survivalist types who have, you know, guns in their homes, also have lots of gold bars, because they believe that gold won't lose its value. And if gold is $700 to the ounce, then they'll be in tall cotton, so to speak. I believe that the Chinese buy American notes because they think it's a good investment. It may not be the best investment because interest rates are lower than they should be. If the Chinese and Japanese were buying less of our debt, instead of interest rates being 4.5%, they might be 6%. But it's not in the interest of the Japanese and the Chinese to see our rates go up real quickly.
Yeah, because we won't buy their product.
There you go. That's the point. The point is there is a dependency.
Right.
You can't just – what's really fascinating and complicated and intriguing about today's world is really no one country is an island, unless you're North Korea. We all have dependencies and relationships with other countries around the world, and we can't just pretend that what we says counts, what other people do don't matter. That's one of my problems with this unilateralist vision that sometimes comes out of Congress people in Washington who never had a passport, never been around the world. The world isn't so simple. other countries, other peoples think about the world differently than we do, and it's very difficult for us to always impose our worldview on other people. The Chinese need the growth because they have lots of young kids looking for work, and they want to supply those industries. They're also an incredibly hardworking, entrepreneurial society, who, as I said, that's kind of their natural basis, and they're trying to reward that by bringing in investment. You know, they could have been like the Japanese and said, we don't want your foreign investment. We don't want your factories. Quite the opposite. They've said, we're going to join the WTO. We're going to learn to do it by the way the advanced countries work. We're going to learn to play by the rules. We're still not doing it yet. And we can argue and debate whether they're really giving their full wholehearted efforts to cracking down on DVD pirates and on copyright pirates, and whether they're really enforcing their labor laws. A lot of times they're not. And that's a real problem, and that's about an immature society learning to create the means of governance. But do the Chinese want to be part of the world? Absolutely. They want to go out and compete and win. And, I mean, if you believe in the whole point of trade, which is that the good companies get better and the bad companies die off, and that through that process of, in a sense, economic evolution, countries find their best path towards economic success. And the Chinese have endorsed that basic plan.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. It's about 8:44, coming up at 9 o'clock.
Is the OMO Variety Hour.
And then followed by Health Watch at 10 o'clock.
Earth Watch at 10:30.
And Democracy Now! At 11. And we have a couple of callers in the buffer. We'll go to our next call. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello, it's you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the guy three quick questions. First of all, when you said that about the cultural situation in China and how America is more interested, one of the things that I'm finding interested in China, there's over 50 different ethnic Chinese, and there's no racism. And I think America could learn a lot from that, and I hope that America's system don't taint that. The next question I have, and you can address that, the next question I have is the connection between America and China as it relates to the war in Afghanistan and opium, the connection there on controlling the drug, the opium trade. The last question I have is that you said that Japan don't want foreign investors in their company. I find that whole argument a little perplexing in the fact that after they dropped the atomic bomb on Japan, America went in, resurrected it, set up all the institutions, and I know that when America set up institutions, they become self-perpetuating. So how is it that America is still not running that country? So I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
You only asked three. Wow. Okay.
Let me start with the third one first, because it's a terrific question, which was basically, how come we don't run the Japanese economy since we help rebuild them? It's kind of the opposite of what's happening in Iraq. You know, we went into Japan in 1945 and said, we bombed this country. We dropped an atom bomb on this country. We firebombed this country. We need to help rebuild this country. And the first people who went to Japan in 1945 were basically what we'd call today liberals. They were 1945 New Dealers who were grown up in the Roosevelt years and believed that government had an opportunity to recreate social society. And they instantly did things like land reform. They installed a new democracy. They began the process of empowering women, doing the stuff that they thought was important to make Japan look more like us. But history very cruelly intervened. And by 1947, only about a year after we got started, we began to see that a war in the Korean Peninsula was looking more and more likely. Mm-hmm. That it was going to be a fight about communism, and we didn't want South Korea to go communist. And it dawned on the people in the Pentagon that one of the best ways to get Japan up and running again would be to recreate a lot of its munitions factories and its bomb-building factories to help us produce weapons for the war in South Korea, or the war in the Korean Peninsula that eventually led to the partition. And to do that as quickly as possible, we put back in power many of the same war criminals who had built the factories that bombed America, that we bombed.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't throw out the Baathists like we did in Iraq and bring in all new people. We went back to the people who had run the government before and said, you know, we need your technical expertise to get us up and running. And before you knew it, Mitsubishi and Mitsui and all the big wartime contractors were back up and running, running their own factories. And to get the economy running, we created a bureaucratic system in Japan as onerous as it had existed before the war. We took a pragmatic approach and said, we need all the help we can get to fight the communists in China. We don't want Japan going communist. We're going to crack down on labor unions. We're going to let the old industrialists take over power again. And we'll have a very subservient Japan do our business for us, but we won't interfere in the domestic economy. And that was the model we used in Japan. And that's why in Japan today you've had 50 years of one-party rule. We call it a democracy, but only one party ever wins, the Liberal Democrats. I don't know if I remembered all three questions.
Chinese
have ethnic groups.
Yeah.
Groups.
Yes.
And
one of the jokes Chinese friend tells me is, you know, if I'm in an airport in Singapore and I see another Chinese, what do I say to him? I have to say hello, because not only are there 25 different ethnic groups, there are lots of linguistic differences. You know, Southern Chinese and Northern Chinese don't speak the same language. So... Yeah. They can read the same newspaper, but they can't speak the same language. So nationalism and ethnic issues have always been around. There are regional differences in China. But that's one of the reasons why nationalism is such an important thread bringing the country together. But there isn't racism in the sense that you might see in this country, because, frankly, if I stood a northerner and a southerner together in a room and they didn't open their mouths, I wouldn't necessarily know one was from the north and one was from the south.
And they wouldn't necessarily know either, except for cultural dress.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So they don't look a different. So there can be, you know, in certain cities, for instance, they might hire you because you're from the same town or the same village as the guy hiring. That's sort of that favoritism or kinship kind of stuff. So that's favoritism, but it isn't racism in that sense.
The other question was on U.S. and China in terms of China's support of the war in Afghanistan.
And
well,
the drug trade.
Well, the Chinese have their own ethnic, quote-unquote, terrorism. They have, you know, Uyghurs, and there's always a question about Tibet. The Tibet question is different, but the Chinese looked at the American situation and said, oh, if you want to crack down on dissidents, we'll help you do that, as long as you won't attack us when we crack down on our own dissidents.
Uh-huh.
It's very easy for, you know, everybody in the world sort of is against terrorism. And this was an opportunity for the Chinese to say, look, we've had our disagreements. You bombed our embassy in Belgrade. We've had these fights over other issues. With this new president, we'd rather find a way to get along with you. And so supporting the war on terrorism was a pretty easy way for the Chinese to say, yeah, okay, we'll support you on this one.
We do have one more caller. We'll try to get in really quickly. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Celeste. My question, maybe you've already discussed this, was what is the situation with the Chinese reevaluating the yuan and denominating oil purchases in it? Before you answer, I wanted to correct a couple of points that the caller was asking about the 9/11 demolition. First of all, he has it wrong.
Go ahead, really quickly.
There were not two buildings. There were three buildings that crumbled in New York City. FEMA secured the area and sold the China did not remove the scrap.
Okay.
We sold it to them.
Okay. It's a very good question about the revaluation of the yuan, or the renminbi. China has, until very recently, had a fixed rate. In other words, 8.2 renminbi to the dollar, and a lot of people felt as if this was undervalued. The China, and it is undervalued. Some people argue by 15% to 20%. The Chinese have recently indicated a willingness to let the renminbi float slightly upwards, but still only raised it about 2 or 3%. The Chinese obviously are advantaged if their currency is cheaper than our own in terms of their exports. It makes their products seem cheaper in overseas markets. There's been some international pressure for them to raise the yuan, to raise the exchange rate. But one of the key differences between China and other economies is that today their currency is not freely traded in international markets. You need a license to buy and sell it. And so this allows the Chinese to, at a certain level, to protect their currency. I suspect that 5 or 7 years from now, that band will loosen even more. The Chinese recognize that over time they need to adjust their currency upwards so that their trade deficit isn't so massive. But they're not in a big hurry to do it right now. So it's a really great question. In terms of oil prices, I doubt that they'll be able to get the Arab countries especially to redenominate oil prices in renminbi. That's probably unlikely. The dollar is still the world currency, and from what I can see, even though we have debts and deficits, still likely to remain the world currency for a while.
We've only have a few minutes left, and
we just scratched the surface.
Lightly touch on political issues. I was wondering if you could briefly talk about Taiwan and Hong Kong in terms of what you see as the future of those territories.
Well, people in Hong Kong aren't happy. People in Hong Kong want direct democracy. They want to be able to vote for their own legislators. Now, in fairness, the British never let them do that either when it was a British colony.
Mm-hmm.
There were actually demonstrations in the street last week in Hong Kong calling for this. There seems to be some indication that the People's Committee in Beijing is beginning to recognize it has to do more to help in terms of changing the system in Beijing. I'm sorry, in Hong Kong, but doesn't seem to be moving very quickly. In terms of Taiwan, that's probably except for North Korea, the flashpoint in Asia, because Taiwan doesn't recognize itself as being a part of China. It recognizes itself as being independent. Now, the independence forces, the president of China now, Chen Shui-bian, is pro-independence, but his party just really lost badly in local elections this month. And there's a sense in Taiwan that the clock is sort of ticking in Beijing's interest, that the day will come that somehow Beijing and Taiwan might be able to make an accommodation of what's called one country, two systems. Because so much of Taiwanese economic activity today is actually taking place in the mainland. The running joke in Taipei today is that the best women, the best food, and the best economic opportunities are all in Shanghai. Everybody's picking up and moving there. So whether or not there's political resolution, there seems to be a lot of economic resolution taking place when the biggest corporations in Taiwan are all investing in the mainland, which is technically where they have technically no diplomatic relationship. So there's always the potential for there to be conflict there, and the United States has promised to basically not allow Taiwan to be invaded. But I also have the sense that the day of rapprochement between these two isn't that far off now, that the Taiwanese recognize that China is becoming so big and so powerful that there'll have to be some accommodation. Ironically for us, Taiwan has become a real model democracy with competitive elections and two parties that fight over issues, mm-hmm. and by Asian standards, relatively clean elections. So we want to support the democratization of Taiwan and basically say, hey, it's up for you guys and the Chinese to settle this peacefully. We're just going to ensure that there'll be no military intervention to force this marriage.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the metropolitan area. This has been a great opportunity to hear about China's economy and how it's going to merge with the world economy. We got so many more questions we'd like to ask you. So hopefully we can re-invite you to More Talk Radio at some time, Michael.
I feel like I'm having a final exam, but sure. I get a lot of good questions this morning. I enjoyed to be with you.
All righty, great. And coming up at 9 o'clock, we have the Old Mole Variety Hours discussing issues and commentary, the politics of the day.
At 10 is Dr. David Naiman. His guest on Health Watch is Ellen Cutler, the author of Micro Miracles, Discover the Healing Power of Enzymes. At 10:30 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Anderson welcomes local slug authority Claudia Groth to talk about the most interesting mollusk. And at 10 on Democracy Now!, more attempts to prevent the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams. I think he's supposed to be executed today or tomorrow?
Yesterday, I think. 14. Yeah,
Tuesday.
An
interview with family members of Christian peace activists kidnapped in Iraq and remembering Richard Pryor, who died on Saturday.
Well, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Michael Zielinziger, who is our resident expert here. And hopefully you will be able to join us another time and we'll talk some more about issues in China.
wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. It's December 12th. You're listening to community-powered KBOO 90.7 FM radio, Portland, Oregon. It's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the Old Mole collective of artists, scholars, and activists root out the larger significance behind recent events and provide interviews, reviews, and views that we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. I'm going to read a quote to you from a famous American writer from 1901, describing the United States playing the European-style imperialist game in the Philippines. So listen to this and see if you can guess who said this. It is yet another civilized power with its banner of the Prince of Peace in one hand and its loot basket and its butcher knife in the other. I'll read that again. It is yet another civilized power with its banner of the Prince of Peace in one hand and its loot basket and its butcher knife in the other. That was Mark Twain commenting in 1901 on the global game that requires force in order to carve up the resources for the loot basket. For many neoliberals and supporters of the capitalist project, it has been clear that for globalism to succeed, the hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. In Thomas Friedman's own words, McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas, the designer of the F-15. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies is called the United States Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps. This is our theme this morning on the Old Mole Variety Hour: globalization and how it is expressed militarily and economically, and how people are fighting back against the interests of powerful nations and corporations to reshape the terms of world trade. Thousands turned out in Portland and the rest of the world this weekend for International Human Rights Day to protest worsening labor and living conditions. And the global human rights movement has turned the spotlight on illegal U.S. imprisonment and torture from Guantanamo to Poland. First this morning, Bill Resnick will speak with Lila Rajiva, journalist and author who is visiting Portland later this week. Rajiva's most recent book is The Language of Empire, Abu Ghraib and the American Media. Fran Michel has also been thinking about empire, torture, and the prison industrial complex, and shares the insights of Michel Foucault and Naomi Klein on these subjects in this week's Well Read Read. And last, I'll be talking with Michael Gagan, director of the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition, about fair trade activism in the Pacific Northwest and the upcoming teach-in on the impacts of free trade to be held this Saturday, December 17th at PSU, coinciding with the WTO meeting this week in Hong Kong. Now, Bill Resnick and Lila Rajiva.
Thanks, Laurie. Lila Rajiva in Baltimore. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you, Bill.
Lila Rajiva's late book, The Language of Empire, Abu Ghraib and the American Media, she's going to be coming to Portland also this Saturday, but at 4 p.m. at, in other words, bookstore, the women's bookstore on a little east of 37th and Hawthorne on Hawthorne at 4. Lila Rajiva, you focus on neoconservative foreign policy, and particularly their discourse and George Bush's discourse of crusade and a lot of people around him and the Middle East. Not long ago, the people that Bush has surrounded himself and the neocons were seen as a little bit nutty and a nutty way of advancing U.S. interests. Tell us about the various schools of U.S. foreign policy, and how did the current one, how did these guys get... and a few women, how did they get ascendant?
Yes, the point you make is a very valid one. How did they move from the nutty fringe right to the center? As you well know, these neoconservatives, some of them have been, I'm thinking specifically of people like Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, they've been involved in U.S. government for some time, Wolfowitz and Pearl, particularly since the 70s. And they were not at the center at that time. In fact, a couple of them were criticized very strongly or relegated to the sideline by the traditional proponents of a strong U.S. foreign policy, the real politic school, you might say, the people who believed in national interest, but who pursued it in a very in a much narrower way, I think, with more delimited objectives than the neoconservatives seemed to. So how did they move to the center? Well, you have to go back to the 60s and 70s and think about what happened then. And one of the most important thing, I would say, was the realization at that time that American power in the Middle East, a position in the Middle East, might be threatened by a resurgent nationalism among Arab states, the oil cartel, the embargo in the 70s that led to the oil shock of the economies. I think people realized that things could change and our economic interests might be threatened by the rising power of Arab nationalism acting as a bloc together. That, it was the time of the peace movement, the anti-nuclear movement, a lot of former colonies were getting together. I think there was a feeling that future power could be threatened. It was then, actually as far back then, that the neoconservative agenda really started getting put into place. In those decades, they contented themselves by taking control of the main think tanks, places like JINSA, CSIS, and so on, and they started writing vehemently from the sidelines and sort of waiting for their moment. And their moment came when the balance of power shifted, when the Soviet Union basically collapsed. And since then, since 1989, what we've seen is that right extreme has moved to the center simply because of that power vacuum that permits them to do that. There is nothing to restrict them. There is no real left in the politics, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And it seems you also write that the use of terror as the terror has sort of replaced the Cold War. These guys managed to create a kind of a foreign policy and a sense of fear and a national mobilization that it seems to me was very good for all kinds of interests within the United States, like the military profiteers, the whole military industry, as well as those who wanted to control the Middle East for its oil and to support this sort of Israeli presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Wolfstetter, Alfred Wolfstetter, Edward Teller, these are the names of people who were involved in exaggerating the Soviet threat when the Soviet threat was present, who exaggerated the number of ballistic missiles that they had, they exaggerated the kinds of defense we needed to use and so on. For a simple purpose, it was driven by a need to funnel money into the defense industry. So the same people who had been doing that, and they were called the Team B agitators in those days in the 70s, they resurfaced in the 90s with exactly the same program, except that whereas formerly they had been dismissed, now they found a more ready environment for the simple reason that, number one, the Soviet check had gone. With the Soviet Union there, you really couldn't get too phantasmagorical in your ideas of foreign policy because there was a reaction that would come. Secondly, also the thought that money would dry up. Without the Cold War to funnel all this money towards the defense industry, what was the need? What was the rationale? So the new rationale was this World War IV, as someone termed it, which has been in the making for some time. I mean, they've had this to replace the Soviet Union for some time. They just needed a receptive audience, and they found it. So there's a kind of an alignment of this extreme neoconservative philosophy about remaking the Middle East, which comes really out of the influence of the Likud party. So you have that aligning itself suddenly with the defense industry, which comes to the cold end of the Cold War saying, now where do we go to have a reason to expand military budgets? How do we prevent ourselves from being cut down or reduced? And that alignment of interest is what happens in the 90s. And when you had Clinton there, Clinton pushed aside or set aside many of these projects, not because fundamentally his goals in foreign policy were that different, but he had a more realistic assessment of how they could be implemented. Whereas today, you do not have people who can successfully implement those ideas. These ideas are kind of wild-eyed and extreme, and they are very visibly so to a large part of the world.
Mm-hmm. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here for The Old Mole, talking to Lila Rajiva, who has a book, The Language of Empire, Abu Ghraib and the American Media. Your book, Lila Rajiva, whereas it focuses on the imagery of, it looks at the imagery of Abu Ghraib, it notes that that imagery is not confined to Abu Ghraib. It was part of the shock and awe strategy. It's part of, I mean, there's a rhetoric now of, especially Bush, he wrote a really interesting essay on his second inaugural address, this imagery of fire and purity and good and evil. I mean, it's a kind of really debased sort of primitive kind of Christianity that was, for a long time, you know, that version was secondary in U.S. foreign policy. It seems to me it's now, why don't you describe that psychology of the sort of this neocon crusade and how it's become ascendant?
Yes, that's a very important element in it that you brought out then, that fire speech. In fact, I wrote a piece on it called Pharisee's Fire Sermon. I think it struck a lot of people, and there were lots of interpretations of where that element of fire, that notion of fire came. It's there, you know, in the Gospels, the Pentecostal fire descending. There's all that kind of apocalyptic fervor that you find. Someone mentioned Dostoevsky. It was actually a quote or a misquote or a mangling of something from Dostoevsky as well. And that tells you something, because people like Michael Ledeen, who is, of course, one of the big ideologues of the neocon project, Michael Ledeen cannot be considered a conservative. The word neoconservative is really a misnomer. He was a former Trotskyite. That was Horowitz. But Ledeen also, his language is very, very, very much drawn from a revolutionary framework. His early work, I think he wrote on the Italian fascists. Much of the language that comes out of these people really can't be called conservative in a traditional sense or in a libertarian sense or even in a prudential sense. It's kind of apocalyptic. It has religious elements to it. It's definitely revolutionary. Some people point out that many of them come from the social democratic side or even from the left and then have moved to the right. And what made them move to the right was, of course, the issue of Israel. And Israel is a kind of a, what shall I say? It's a definitive part of the neocon project, support for Israel. So I think some of that is some of that religious fervor comes actually out of pro-Israel or Zionist fundamentalism. I mean, that's an element that people haven't analyzed. People talk about this whole project in terms of Christian fundamentalists and neoconservatives uniting. But there's also an element of Jewish fundamentalism that comes out of Gush Emunim and the people in Israel who are hardliners. There are lots of ties between the hardline Likud party and their supporters and their sympathizers in the U.S. government. So there's that as well. Now, the fire element, the emphasis on fire goes way back when. It really goes back to the Second World War, post-war period, when a lot of people analyzed and learned from Nazi methods of subjugation of populations. I think there's a book by Harlan Ullman, which I reference in my book, which actually talks rather admiringly of the comatose and shocked expressions of populations that had been subjected to firebombing. He was actually talking specifically of the British firebombing of Dresden.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of that studying of the methods used in the Second World War, quite a lot of the technique and psychology that permeates this administration actually arises. The understanding of psychological control, humiliation, domination as the first line of attack in war. So there are a lot of things that don't make sense in a military from a military point of view. Kind of the excessive use of force that you think would actually be counterproductive in so many ways are used specifically, for instance, in the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad, as a means of psychologically crushing the population. There's no other way of talking about it. So that indeed is terror. I mean, what else is terror?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to talk about terror or torture, you can't see them separately because you'll see the same psychological component to it, which I think they've refined and brought to quite a degree of science.
Right. You know, your book reminded me of things that I've read of prior examinations of the the imperialist mind and the, it seems to me, the debasement, self-debasement, and ultimately sort of fantastic elaboration of craziness by the colonists. And I'm reminded of, you know, Fanon's work, but also particularly Albert Memmi, The Colonizer and the Colonists, an old book, but really quite wonderful. It sort of describes what happens when the conflict begins intensifying and the ways in which the colonizer or the imperialist elaborate this sort of get caught up in this psychology of good and evil and how they have to crush evil. How do you see that? Do you see a continuity in the U.S. imperial project and the craziness that it's developing with prior imperialist projects?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think you can't focus on America as being some kind of special case of empire, because, except in the sense that, of course, it is a special case because it is the most powerful state that has ever existed in relative and in absolute terms. But on another level, yes, it's very similar to previous empires as well. I maybe came a little bit late to that awakening. I've never really subscribed completely to the theory that America was an empire. It was an empire of a different kind, maybe, but I never really liked or used that word much. But of late, it's really impossible to say anything else except to use the word empire in relation to the Bush administration. The gloves are off, whatever you want to say. It's very open and overt. The continuity is there. The difference is that, and this is a similarity with the British Empire, which is, of course, that they're bringing the, you know, civilizing mission to the world and so on. In the American Empire, it's not stated so much in terms of civilizing people. That would be impossible because this is a multi-ethnic country. It would be very difficult to overtly state certain things that were possible, say, for the 19th century empires. So instead, it comes in the guise of a kind of universalism. It's not so much American values that are being imposed or exported. We are now preaching universal values, like it's human rights. So I'm very suspicious of this human rights language. And the Bush administration is not the first to use it. If we go right back, I mean, I think maybe some Democrats would not want to remember this. It was Jimmy Carter's administration, actually, which was very strongly for the human rights rationale for intervention. So was the Clinton administration. And with Carter, it was under Carter that Zbigniew Brzezinski actually encouraged the rise and the development and the strengthening of Islamic fundamentalism as a provocation to the Soviet state in Afghanistan. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that he encouraged those Islamic freedom fighters, not after the invasion, but actually prior to the invasion as a kind of a provocation. So if we go right back, that human rights and all this was used as a cover for interventionism right back in the 70s, and that continues today. But so it's not specifically under civilizational war. There's people like Huntington who will talk about civilizational war, but it's very difficult today in the 20th century to get up and say we are civilizing the barbarians. We are bringing this is the white man's burden. All that is not going to happen. So it has a new guise, and I'm not going to say it's entirely a guise. I think there's some genuine belief in it as well, that these are universal values. You know, you think of someone like Francis Fukuyama. He thought the end of history had been reached. Surprise, it hadn't. But he really thought he could imagine nothing else except the liberal, democratic, capitalist state, complete with corporate propaganda, corporate advertising, consumerism, all that. That is his only possible future for the world. So people who believe that are going to believe that it's logical and inevitable that all countries develop like us. And that is a form of, I don't know if you want to call it imperialism, but it's certainly a form of chauvinism.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me sometimes that sort of late capitalism and its utter sort of degradation and dismissal of any values besides sort of efficiency and profit that is in the public sphere leads to this creation of these sort of bizarre utopias, kind of religious utopias, and the neocons have. They combine these two utopias, that is, a sort of religious transcendence along with political transcendence, their sort of bourgeois utopia of democracy, that they're going to... It seems to me the psychology of it comes out of partly out of the the value debasement of sort of, you know, late 20th or early 21st century globalization.
No, you put your finger on it exactly, and I think I talk a little about that in Chapter 7 when I talk about the spiritual element in all this. In one way, when you look at it, okay, you say this is the development of late capitalism. I'm not, you know, I don't necessarily understand or subscribe to every part of Marxist analysis, but it, you know, when you look at it overtly, you say, okay, monopoly capitalism, state control, this expansion and desire for markets, it's all there. But it's not entirely an economic thing. And in the neoconservatives, I find actually a rejection of economic man in a lot of their writing. And in fact, in the fervor and the kind of compulsiveness with which they enunciate their doctrines. There's something definitely spiritual, not in the sense of good or ethical, but spiritual in the sense that they seem to see a kind of self-transcending of man that takes place. When they talk about war, they enjoy it. They want it, this creative destruction. Yeah. The best in America comes out of it.
Right. Well, George Bush seems to me just this tragic and crazy character coming out of the wealthiest, you know, sector of America, utterly privileged, but utterly empty, who then finds, you know, human beings need meaning, who then finds a sort of source of meaning consistent with his class position. Of course, the source of meaning could have broke with them, like, let's say, some of the Rockefeller kids and become sort of lefties you know, eco spirits but he didn't, of course, break with his class position because he was really so poorly educated, it seems to me, and such a fraternity boy that he became this kind of he sought meaning in this you know, this combination of this sort of crusade for democracy, crusade for purity.
Yeah,
he's really an interesting character in some ways, his emptiness that he fills up with that.
Yeah, I think the word tragic is really good to use about him. I think people have looked at him more negatively. I mean, one can be negative a lot about him, I agree. But I do see the element of tragedy. I see him as a victim of his own weaknesses. I see that emptiness, and I think it's because of the emptiness that actually he's able to be projected in this fashion as this huge heroic figure. People somehow connect. They see that very lack of articulateness, which disturbs some people, and I don't necessarily think that lack of articulateness is a lack of intelligence, but in his case, that might be the case too as well. But I think it's easy for a lot of people to connect with him and read what they want into him simply because of emptiness. You can put whatever you want into that vessel. You can see a Christian fundamentalist. You can see a great heroic American leader, a working class guy. I don't know how people read that into such a wealthy, privileged human being, but they do.
Yeah, well, he plays all of those roles, and he's pretty good. Like Reagan, he's pretty capable of playing the roles, and lots of people want those. You know, that it's consistent with their interests, and they sort of accept it.
Yeah.
But there's another set. Let's conclude. This is the old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick talking to Lila Rajiva, whose book, The Language of Empire, Abu Ghraib in the American Media. She's going to be at Another Words bookstore at 4 o'clock this coming Saturday to not just talk about her book, but to talk about the new imperialism and particularly its symbolism and discourse. And there seems that there are, at the end of your book, you talk about the potentials, at least you bring up the need for some kind of an international movement where the American working people and the people struggling all over the world, there really is an international movement now, where that gets stronger and pushes back and ultimately defeats the kind of the imperial project. What do you see in American life? It seems to me that Bush's craziness does, in fact, resonate with a lot of people, but it also puts off a lot of people, and he's begun now, it seems to me, to put off pretty much everybody but his base. How do you see that happening, and what's the task for, I mean, what can radio people do, and the rest of us, and yourself, to contribute to a change in U.S. politics?
Well, I think actually what's happened so far is encouraging. I mean, yes, the war went on and so on, but, you know, the speed with which it has become unpopular is really quite remarkable. And that has to be attributed at least in some measure to activists, to writers, people in America, abroad, who have been, you know, getting on the net, web activists, community radio. They've just produced an alternative voice that people didn't have before. And I think you should not underestimate the power of this voice, because the corporate media does not necessarily acknowledge it. It does not mean that it is not powerful. We find more and more articles are referencing bloggers, they're referencing community radio, which means that they are realizing that credibility has left the corporate media and has gone into the alternative journalists. So that's one thing. I think there have been some successes. Number two, what to do? I believe that we really have to enlarge the debate and not be stuck with only looking at traditional allies. I think there are potential allies in a lot of places. For instance, churches. I don't think fundamentalism as such is the problem. I think certain brands of fundamentalism, which are politically engaged, are the problem. So I think we can go to a lot of churches and find allies there.
Lila Rajiva, sorry, I shouldn't have asked that question then. We're sort of out of time, but you're going to be in Portland this Saturday, 4 o'clock, in other words, bookstore. We can continue this kind of conversation, and I'm sure you'll be talking about the possibilities of changing U.S. the way the empire is operating. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Right. So long.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and Lila Rajiva. And coming up, Fran Michel with this week's Well Read Red.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel with the Well Read Red, thinking about surveillance and punishment, torture and rendition, habeas corpus, and the notion of sovereignty. In short, the U.S. government practice of kidnapping foreign nationals and U.S. citizens and secretly flying them to prisons where they're tortured. In French historian Michel Foucault's 1975 book, Discipline and Punish, he presents two models of penality. On the one hand is the medieval monarchical system characterized by public execution and corporal punishment, where secret investigations routinely involve the use of torture. On the other hand is the modern carceral system of the nation-state society, exemplified by timetables of prisoners' activities and obligations, a system that sought to penetrate the soul rather than the body, and to provide control through discipline. Historian Peter Linebaugh, in an essay on counterpunch.org last year, points out that torture tends to accompany capitalist or primitive accumulation, and he suggests that, indeed, torture is part of creating the bodies that can then be subjected to the more subtle forms of control that come to the fore in the industrial age. Quote, "Capitalist work discipline requires the mechanistic philosophy. It requires the enclosures and mapping of the world from the neighborhood to the GPS. It requires the tick-tick-ticking of the clock, the squared-out grid of the calendar of our days. It prohibits nakedness in public bathing. It forbids games of chance and games on the open field. It requires a belief in work, an ideology of work, a creed in work, and salvation through work. Labor power becomes self-managed." End quote. Or, as Foucault asks, is it surprising that prisons resemble factories, schools, barracks, hospitals, which all resemble prisons? The two styles of penal control, then, can coexist. One does not simply or completely replace the other because they serve different aspects of economic development. Attempts to limit the power of the sovereign monarch go back at least to the 1215 Magna Carta, the great charter that the English barons imposed to limit the power of King John. Chapter 39 of the Magna Carta, in a 17th century translation, says, "No free man shall be taken or imprisoned or be deprived of his freehold or liberties or free customs or be outlawed or exiled or any otherwise destroyed, nor will we not pass upon him nor condemn him, but by lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land." From this and the commentaries upon it descend the right of habeas corpus, trial by jury, due process, and prohibition of torture as principles of law. But Linebaugh calls our attention to the specific application of these rights to the free man designated in the Magna Carta. He notes that it was in the era of the witch hunts of Europe and the genocide of indigenous people in America, of the commencement of the African slave trade, that the scientific use of torture was born, for blood and torture were necessary to breed an animal capable of regular, homogeneous, and uniform behavior, indelibly marked with the memory of the new rules. Naomi Klein in The Nation this week also points out that the rules are not so new, and recent events hardly mark the first time the U.S. government has used torture to wipe out its political opponents. Nor is it the first time the U.S. has operated secret prisons or actively supported regimes that tried to erase the left by dropping students out of airplanes. What is unprecedented about the Bush administration's open embrace of torture, Klein stresses, is not the torture, but the openness. Past administrations tactfully kept their black ops secret. The crimes were sanctioned, but they were practiced in the shadows, officially denied and condemned. The Bush administration has broken this deal. Post 9/11, it demanded the right to torture without shame, legitimized by new definitions and new laws. Despite all the talk of outsourced torture, the Bush administration's real innovation has been its insourcing, with prisoners being abused by U.S. citizens, in U.S.-run prisons, and transported to third countries in U.S. planes. It is this departure from clandestine etiquette, more than the actual crimes, that has so much of the military and intelligence community up in arms. By daring to torture unapologetically and out in the open, Bush has robbed everyone of plausible deniability. Klein sees this shift as of huge significance. When torture is covertly practiced, but officially and legally repudiated, there is still the hope that if atrocities are exposed, justice could prevail. When torture is pseudo-legal, and when those responsible merely deny that it is torture, what dies is what Hannah Arendt called the judicial person in man. Soon enough, victims no longer bother to search for justice, so sure are they of the futility and danger of that quest. This impunity is a mass version of what happens inside the torture chamber, where prisoners are told they can scream all they want because no one can hear them and no one is going to save them. In addition to the historical precedents in previous CIA and other international uses of kidnapping and torture, there is precedent for the abusive treatment of prisoners in the domestic prison system. Lynn Washington Jr., writing last week in Counterpunch.org, reminds us that Charles Grainer, one of the U.S. soldiers featured in the infamous sex abuse photos at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, was a prison guard at a Pennsylvania maximum security prison and was the subject of inmate abuse complaints there. In an April 2005 commentary, Mumia Abu-Jamal asked, "Is it mere coincidence that some of the most brutal, most vicious actors at Abu Ghraib were U.S. reserves who, in their civilian lives, were prison guards? How else could they learn it?" Abu-Jamal has been housed in the same maximum security prison where Grainer worked. Washington cites Bonnie Kerness, coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee's Prison Watch Program, who points out that beatings, hoodings, isolation, stun belts, and sexual humiliations are also used in the domestic U.S. prison system. Norman Solomon made a similar point last August on CommonDreams.org, where he emphasized that both at home and abroad, imprisonment and abuse of prisoners seems to have a lot to do with class and race. The U.S. leads the world in percentage of citizens incarcerated, with more than 2 million people now behind bars. And with 63% of those people black or Latino, the incarcerated population is vastly skewed toward low-income people of color. Solomon quotes psychiatrist Terry Cooper saying, "I do not view the sexual abuse, torture, and humiliation of Iraqi prisoners by American soldiers as an isolated event. The plight of prisoners in the USA is strikingly similar to the plight of the Iraqis who were abused by American GIs. Prisoners are maced, raped, beaten, starved, left naked in freezing cold cells, and otherwise abused in too many American prisons, as substantiated by findings in many courts that prisoners' constitutional rights to remain free of cruel and unusual punishment are being violated." Cooper adds, "In order for the abuses to continue, one group has total control over another. The victims feel that they have no recourse, and the perpetrators are confident that they can get away with it." I'll close with the words again of Peter Linebaugh from last year's Counterpunch. "The mutilation of the human body and the globalization of commerce are two sides of capitalism, empire, and torture. The regime prevailing in the USA is lawless, cruel, and inhuman. And though it will plead that its atrocities are accidents or that they should be exculpated, having been motivated in good faith, such excuses scarcely scratch the surface of its crimes, because its deepest purposes and strategic goals are the very primitive accumulation and endless dominion which characterized its beginnings in the age of plunder. Structural adjustment and special access are but new names for an old crime. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel with the Well-Read Red.
Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Michael Gagan, director of the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition, which I understand, Michael, was founded in 2004 to fight CAFTA. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in fact, it was a resurrection of an Oregon Fair Trade Coalition that came together about 10 years ago to fight NAFTA. And there was this idea to sort of bring back together all the different people who'd come together around free trade and sit down again and confront this issue that's still totally with us and that we're still facing.
Now, in addition to directing the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition, you're also global trade chair of the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. And this week, the World Trade Organization, the WTO, is meeting in Hong Kong in an attempt to implement anti-labor, anti-environmental, and anti-democratic trade policies. And there are a number of activities in Portland protesting and educating about the so-called free trade, including the march that was held this Saturday and a teach-in to be held next Saturday. And we'll talk more about that teach-in a little later. But the widespread global opposition to these policies has been growing. And many of us look to Seattle in 1999 as that watershed moment when many groups came together to protest some of the unfair trade policies that were being implemented, crafted and implemented by large national governments and the capitalist community. So maybe you could tell us about the evolution of fair trade activism in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I think Seattle was such a watermark moment. There's so many people who I talk to, even now when I do presentations on trade, a lot of times I'll start by saying, you know, who in this room was in Seattle? And I'm always amazed to see how many hands go up or how many people talk about that and remember that as such a magical moment of being able to take on something that's so big and it sometimes seems very far removed from what happens on an everyday level, and people being able to congregate in Seattle and make a very clear statement of that. It was a really magical moment. And that sort of was building on stuff that had already been happening around the world that just didn't get a lot of attention in the U.S. And it sent a whole message around the world around people being able to take on the WTO and not just sort of sit by or feel like it was being done to us without having a role in it. And you're seeing that this week in Hong Kong, there's 140-some-odd countries that have come together with their negotiators of the WTO, but there's been a huge response all around the world of people. So remembering Seattle, remembering the other events that have gone along with that, and saying that we don't want it. And you're seeing that in Seattle, and you saw it here in Portland on Saturday. I think there was between 700 and 1,000 people who marched through the streets of Portland, again, with that same message that the WTO, at the end of the day, doesn't really reflect the priorities and values of people in Portland, people in Eugene and Roseburg on a local level. What actually is playing out on the ground doesn't really match up with the promises that have been made around the WTO and free trade.
So what are groups such as the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition trying to do to change the parameters of what we might consider fair trade and what the global community, the majority of the people in the world, really desire in terms of social justice, economic rights, human rights? How can we redirect these global organizations into considering what the majority really wants?
I think that's playing out in a couple different ways, in really neat ways. And you see that in developing countries with a much stronger voice from campesino and farm organizations being very clear about the path of development of big multinational corporations setting up their operations there don't actually benefit people and questioning that end of it. But you also see it here in the States with, there's a real rising awareness of what outsourcing is doing to our economy. There's a real rising awareness that, you know, everybody knows the thing that you used to be able to work one job to sustain your family, and now it's two. And in a lot of low-income sectors in Oregon, you find people who are working three jobs between a married couple to sustain their family. Like, the trends of jobs that paid $17 an hour leaving the country and forcing people into jobs that pay minimum wage or just above minimum wage is something that people are putting together and saying, this isn't just a coincidence. This is totally a pattern that's happening. And free trade, this idea of just shipping out jobs all across the world, isn't actually getting to the heart of developing the countries that receive those jobs or doing much for the Oregon economy over the long run.
Now, NAFTA eliminated about 1 million jobs, I think, and CAFTA promises to eliminate more. And the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition has been involved in a very interesting project talking with workers who have lost their jobs due to these free trade agreements. And what are you finding from those interviews that you and others are conducting with people around the state who have been impacted by NAFTA and other trade agreements?
That's the Stories Project that we're doing through the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition. And it was set up on the idea that in Oregon we've lost, I think the AFL-CIO of Oregon estimates, over 50,000 jobs that have been lost due to trade. And we started to say, you know, the images that people got from the protests in Seattle, for instance, were of, you know, black-clad protesters. But it kind of got pigeonholed into that sort of radical politics segment. People forgot that there were thousands of labor protesters, people from the environment, people representing family farmers there. We started to say, well, who actually is being impacted by free trade in Oregon? And who's it looking for their stories and really valuing what their experience and putting that at the center of our work? So we're interviewing people who've had their jobs outsourced in high tech. We're interviewing people from food processing who've lost their jobs in places like Hermiston out in Nissa, Oregon. Going to some of the smaller communities in Oregon where, you know, when you lose 650 jobs, that's not just, you know, a drop in the bucket. That's the economic mainstay. And you have the Department of Labor saying, yes, this was a trade-related closure. The J.R. Simplot closure of the potato processing plant in Hermiston is a great example. It took the biggest employer out of Hermiston, and then it affects their school board. It affects their housing prices. There, people have real questions about where they're going to look for work, whether they're going to just get outsourced in the next onion processing plant they go to down the road. So we're really getting a different perspective on what free trade looks like from people who live here in Oregon.
Can you give us some examples about some of the people whose lives have been impacted by these shutdowns and, you know, put a human face on some of these statistics?
Yeah, I was really struck. Some of the stories are heartbreaking. Some of them are really inspiring, too. But definitely, it's, I think some of the stories I come across are people who are in their early 30s. They've lost their job. They have access to some retraining benefits, and they're thinking about, you know, how am I going to take advantage of these educational benefits and figure out a way to transition to something more stable. And in some of those cases, they aren't happy. There's a woman we met in Hermiston. She is a mother of two. Her husband works as an electrician. She lost her job, and she's training to do some more tech-end work in refrigeration and food processing. And she's excited to take on that challenge, but she's still very resentful about the fact that that plant closed. People with 25 years, 28 years of experience got laid off so that J.R. Simplot could move to Canada, open a new factory, and just do fresh hires across the board. That sense of not being accountable to a community that's put so much work and time and effort into building this plant and making it one of the most productive in the state, and then getting turned around and being told the next day, you know, you have no job. Your job's over. It's hard to hear stories of people saying what it was like to actually sit in the lunchroom and hear from their top management their plant was closing. And almost that sense of shock and disbelief when that news really hits home. And then figuring out, you know, what are you going to do next and where are you going to go next? I've talked to a couple people who lost their jobs. I talked to a woman who was working in Troutdale in an aluminum plant that shut down there due to trade. Then she went to work for Freightliner. She got laid off at Freightliner when they closed down the parts plant and sent it to Mexico. So there's a sense of, you know, whereas people used to be able to take their job for granted, now there's this real insecurity about, you know, where am I going to go next? People worked, you know, 25 years and feel the physical effects of doing manual labor for 25 years, being told that you have to go out and get another job and wondering, well, you know, with the physical disabilities that have come along with the work they've done, who's going to want to hire them? Who's going to want to take them next? Those are a lot of the themes that come through the interviews.
How are these trade agreements affecting the right to organize? I mean, I've read that every 23 minutes in the United States, a worker is fired or discriminated against for union activity, which is a right enshrined in the International Declaration of Human Rights. And I know that the march on and the rally on Saturday was in commemoration of International Human Rights Day.
You see that play out. I was just talking to a guy at that march who said that he was on the negotiating committee for his work site. He was with the printers union. And he remembers being told, you know, just the implied message, don't ask for too much of a raise. Don't be too pushy. Because we've got to keep our costs down with the implicit threat of, you know, or we're going to have to outsource. Global competition, we've got to stay competitive, and that means, you know, that you have to eat the costs of sort of downsizing or trimming back. That whole downward pressure on wages, and especially at a time when medical benefits are just getting more and more expensive, that's a real factor, and it really has that sort of chilling effect. I'm being able to look at, well, what's a living wage here? What do we need to get by? All of a sudden, people are worried, well, are they going to take our job and send it overseas? And there are specific cases, and it's a complicated one, but down in the Pick Sweet mushroom plant that Pecun was organizing, ultimately they shut that plant down, largely in response to the organizing that was taking place. Those people qualified for Trade Act retraining. There's a whole piece in there about being able to just pick up and move in response to labor organizing or when the demands come down the line, that makes it very difficult to hold employers accountable.
Well, many defenders of free trade, including Thomas Friedman, I quoted from at the beginning of the hour today, in talking about the hidden fist along with the economic policies, but Friedman and others who support free trade claim that this is a transitional period. The U.S. economy has to adjust to a service economy, and we have to allow the rest of the world to develop. These jobs abroad are providing people around the world opportunities heretofore not imagined. But what is the impact abroad with the explosion of new jobs from all of these corporations relocating to follow the cheapest labor.
I think this is one of the parts that just drives me crazy about the whole free trade debate that totally backs up the whole logic behind the WTO. It sounds so nice and sugar-coated when it's presented from these abstract economic perspectives. Oh, it's an economic shift. It's good. And you saw that who is the Secretary of the Treasury in 2004 for the Bush administration came out and said, outsourcing is just a new way of doing business. And in the long run, it's going to make our economy stronger. And these are always, you never hear these quotes from people who are actually working day-to-day in manufacturing plant. You always hear it from people who are able to do that from the luxury of their armchair or from far away. And what the question, look at the agreements we've passed, like NAFTA. We've lost so many jobs in the course of implementing NAFTA and seeing those jobs move overseas. Are the people who receive those jobs really getting paid enough to be able to buy the stuff we're exporting? Are they really getting, you know, Hewlett-Packard printers and Nike shoes? No, we're exporting these jobs, and we're doing it to the countries that have the lowest labor standards and the lowest environmental standards. And there's a corporate bottom line that does pretty well. But the actual, like, there's a whole trickle-down logic to that that isn't actually playing out. So the people who receive those jobs aren't getting paid enough to really be able to benefit from it in the long run.
Well, let's talk about some success stories. You mentioned earlier the whole issue of outsourcing, and I know the Fair Trade Coalition was involved in pressuring the Kulongoski administration into prohibiting outsourcing of Oregon State jobs. Do you want to say something about that coalition that was successfully able to pressure the governor into changing?
There were a whole bunch of folks who sort of stepped up on that, and I think the governor was ultimately sympathetic from the start, which really helped. But the Oregon AFL was in there, the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition was in there, a number of people sort of stepped up and said, that is not something that has to be that way or that has to happen, that we just sit back passively and just watch our call center jobs move overseas. Let's actually make a decision. And in the case where that was the TANF workers who respond to calls around food stamps, let's actually make a decision about how we're going to spend tax dollar money to employ people, at least in this country, to be able to take those calls and handle them and get the response. And the governor stepped up and demanded that those call centers be moved. I think they were in India at the time that really sort of broke as an issue. And it's an example of being able to find solutions. It's not that hard once you really put your mind to it. But make decisions to say, you know, with our taxpayer money, let's put those tax dollars back into the economy here. So we're making sure that we're creating new jobs and just thinking that through clearly instead of sort of passively hoping that things work out.
Well, Michael, because we're running a bit out of time, let's talk about the teach-in that's coming up this Saturday. This is a teach-in organized by a number of groups, and maybe you could mention some of the sponsors. The title of the teach-in is The Impacts of Free Trade, Local to Global. It will be held this Saturday, December 17th, from 10 to 4 at the Koinonia House across from PSU, and I think that's Broadway in Montgomery.
Yeah.
So what's happening on Saturday?
That's going to be actually a really neat event on the 17th. And it's a chance for people who have been involved with trade stuff in the past or people who are sort of just getting curious about what the whole story is to sit down and reflect on what's going on and hear from some really great speakers and local experts on this stuff. So there's going to be a workshop on labor, on immigration, how trade affects the environment and food security, impacts in Oregon, and sponsored by all kinds of neat organizations. I think the Oregon AFL is a sponsor, along with Jobs with Justice, the PCASC, the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee, the Sierra Club. There's a whole host of different labor unions that have really come together to support it, specific unions. And I wish I had the whole list because I'm sure I'm leaving some great people off. But people should come down and check that out on the 17th across the street from PSU. And pick a couple of workshops and go and listen to folks like Paul Thiers, who's coming down from Vancouver, who's an expert in ag issues and how trade is affecting farmers worldwide. Listen to some of the labor folks talking about the actual impacts of trade on being able to negotiate good contracts or organize new union sites. Come down and check that out. And I think it'll be a really fun community event to really evaluate where we're going next and where we've come from on these issues.
Michael, is there a contact person or a website that people can go to find out more information or information about registering?
I think the best site for people to look up information on is going to be the Portland Indie Media site. That's portlandindiemedia.org. Excuse me, portland.indiemedia.org to keep posted on the latest of news around how to register for that. But the most important thing is just to come down. You don't have to register in advance or sign up. It's really accessible, and it's really designed for people who haven't necessarily spent a lot of time thinking about this to sort of see how it relates to you and figure out why this is important to you. So that's going to be next Saturday, December 17th at 10 a.m.
What do you hope happens with this convergence of various groups and people on Saturday?
I think the most important thing, I really value at the march how many different kinds of people turned out and marched together. And what I love about the teach-in is it's going to be this interactive forum to really sit down and talk and hear a lot of different perspectives. If you know about labor, well, come down and listen to food security and some of the concerns that Oregon growers have about how we're providing locally for our food sources. Come down and listen to immigration issues and see how that's playing out, because that's a really important angle to how free trade plays out both in Oregon and abroad. And it's a great time to just hear something new and sort of pick up a new piece of this puzzle of what trade is and how it's impacting Oregon.
Well, thanks very much, Michael Gagan, for coming down to KBOO this morning. Michael, I've been speaking with Michael Gagan of the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition and also one of the organizers of a teach-in this Saturday, The Impacts of Free Trade, free in quotes, Local to Global, Saturday, December 17th, 10 o'clock in the morning to 4 p.m. at the Koinonia House across from PSU. And thanks again, Michael. And that wraps it up for this morning's Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Laurie Mercier, and I have one last announcement to make about three independent documentary films looking at gay women's experiences, expression, and desire on December 14th this week, 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. Act Out and Boxo Productions will sponsor a screening of three independent shorts that examine gender expression, life experiences, and erotic desire in the gay women's community. And I believe these are locally produced and about the local gay women's community. Thank you again. This has been Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, Dr. David Damon's guest on Health Watch is Ellen Cutler, author of... No, it isn't. Sorry. Wrong guest. Wrong guest. Dave will... Dr. Damon will make amends for my misspeaking. At 10:30 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen welcomes local slug authority Claudia Groth to talk about the most interesting mollusks. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, more on attempts to prevent the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams, an interview with family members of Christian peace activists kidnapped in Iraq, and remembering Richard Pryor, who died on Saturday. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Way of Health, a nonprofit health clinic emphasizing internal medicine, including special programs for mental health issues such as depression or anxiety, Chinese medicine, and acupuncture. The Way of Health is located at the corner of Southeast Market at 106th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-788-4165 or kehatsu.us. That's kehatsu.us. And also by Foodfront Cooperative Grocery, specializing in foods from local and organic producers. Foodfront is located in Northwest Portland at 24th and Northwest Thurman. For more information, the number there is 503-222-5658. Okay, here comes Health Watch. The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Jackie Gethner. Jackie Gethner has been a licensed massage therapist since 1988. She has a private practice here in Portland, as well as working as an educator and presenter nationally and internationally. Her workshops provide hands-on skills to teach others techniques that people can use on themselves to stay healthy. Jackie Gethner works with diverse populations, ranging from working with people suffering from chronic ailments or end-of-life issues to couples massage. Jackie Gethner is here today to talk about holiday self-care, how to keep oneself healthy through the holiday season. And if you'd like to join the conversation or ask any questions, the number here at the studio is 503-231-8187. Welcome to Health Watch, Jackie.
Well, thank you.
So why don't you tell us your thoughts about how you chose this topic and in your relationship to holiday self-care?
Well, it's always been very interesting to me to watch people's experience during the holidays. Having been brought up in a Jewish family, I wasn't quite caught up in the holiday Christmas kinds of things that went on. But every year it just seemed that people were experiencing more issues around stress than what I thought the holiday was supposed to be about, which was about coming together and families and the whole religious aspect of it and those kinds of things. So what ended up seeming to be the case that there were a lot of expectations that sometimes could never be met. And so it was really important for me to let people know whether they had families in a lot of these issues or some of the feelings that come up for people around not having the families they would have wanted to have had around at this time, that there were still options for still having a good holiday and being able to feel healthy.
So I'm imagining there's a wide range of ways this may express itself in different people, from what you mentioned, some of the emotional stresses, but also ways that it may manifest physically in the body.
Right. One of the most obvious that I see is headaches, because people are more prone to headaches these days than I think they ever have been because of stress. And part of that is also complicated by the fact that in the winter we drink less water than we do in the summer, where it's more of a natural kind of thing to do. And people think if they drink, you know, hot buttered rums and hot chocolate, that that's just as good. And it really isn't, because the body has to work hard to digest those things. So people's bodies aren't as hydrated as they should be, which tends to lend to more headaches, say, for example.
So in your practice, if you're having people come in specifically to address some of the stresses, maybe of having to eat a diet that they're not used to eating over the holidays, mm-hmm. or seeing family members they may or may not want to see, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having problems with chronic headaches. Where do you start with them?
Well, first I start by identifying what the problem is, because that in itself takes some of the pressure off. Then I talk with them about the whole concept of breathing, which we all still do a pretty poor job of, and how that in itself can decrease or sometimes just in itself alleviate headache issues. Then we talk about the water issue. And then I also just talk about when we get kind of caught up in the flow of the holiday or the stress of the holiday, we tend to really, as I said before, quit breathing. And whenever you're paying attention, you're fearful or you're in pain, we tend to hold our breath. And just in doing that, how increases the circulation of blood to the brain and allows the body to relax. And generally, I demonstrate that for them. And they can see a big difference in itself.
Well, I saw on your website that you teach a lot of self-help techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Are there pressure points that someone can do if they're experiencing a headache?
Absolutely, absolutely. The one that most people are familiar with is in the web of the hand between the thumb and the first finger. Not on that little fleshy part, but if you go in a little deeper on the hand, is what's called the anatomical snuff box, because the old colonial guys used to sniff snuff there. So if you have a headache on the left side of your head, if you can get in there and massage that area and breathe, you'll start to feel those muscles relax. And it sometimes you have to go back and do it again 15 or 20 minutes later, but that works. And the same thing on the right side. If you have a headache across your whole head, you don't have to do both sides at once, but just do that. Drink a little bit of water, and it seems to help quite a bit.
We're talking today with Jackie Gethner about self-care during the holiday season. If you'd like to join the conversation here on Health Watch, the number is 503-231-8187. And do you recommend, Jackie, specific foods or medicines in your practice regarding the headaches?
Well, people's allergies are a whole other issue in terms of headache kinds of things. Most people, as they get older, certainly know what foods will trigger headaches and generally try to stay away from them. But you certainly see a lot of overeating over the holidays. It's just, oh, just one more piece of cinnamon bark or one more piece of almond roca. And that can really throw your body into a greater imbalance, which could create the headaches. I think it's really important. I do a lot of aromatherapy in my practice, so one of the things I would suggest would be a drop of lavender at the base of the skull or on your temples as a way to kind of work with headaches also.
Well, let's take our first caller. Welcome to Health Watch. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for the program. Ma'am, I have a fibromyalgia, osteoporosis, TMJ, and some other things. And the unfortunate thing about that is that I don't have the income to get massage or other things like that. And unfortunately, I have to access Oregon Health Plan dentists, and they're generally, maybe all dentists are, insensitive to my physical problems, and I have no concern about at least making my neck comfortable during their different treatments.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like somebody with healthy chutzpah to regularly pressure the dental school system, whether it's in Oregon or the country, countrywide, to get massage and hopefully acupuncture into their as a requirement in their curriculum, whether they're dental assistants or dentists. I think that would be mentally healthy for all people in this country. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Can I address that for a second? I totally agree with you. Part of the reason that I teach the way that I teach is because I work mostly with people who are on limited incomes for a number of reasons. And so I really try to teach as many skills as I can so that people can take better care of themselves. Obviously, going and getting a massage is the ultimate, but not everybody does have the ability to do that. So I try to go in and teach groups of people who want to learn how to work on each other, families, those kinds of things, so that you can have those skills. In terms of jaw stuff and dentists and those kinds of things. Unfortunately, there are becoming to be too many massage therapists out there in terms of not necessarily being trained really well, but people out there doing massage. The chiropractic school has just started a massage program. It'd be great if dentists hired on-site massage therapists to offer those kinds of things before people came in. But what I would encourage you to do is be more of an advocate for yourself and go in and talk about this neck posture isn't comfortable for me. I have fibromyalgia, and maybe you can carry a fold-up towel or a pillow that's comfortable that you can then use to make yourself feel more comfortable. And one of the things I'll share with you, especially around TMJ stuff, is you can go in and it'll be very tender, just a couple of seconds, and work on your cheek, on the front and the back, and stimulate the circulation in there, which will relax your jaw and it'll help your TMJ.
Well, let's take another caller. Welcome to Health Watch on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I've got a friend who has, well, it's just an unfortunate problem because he gets headaches when he drinks beer. And I don't know, I've been talking to him about it, and so he'll have a beer with me occasionally. He always has to take aspirin prior to that. Any kind of idea what would cause that?
Probably some kind of allergy, maybe to the yeast or to the hops or something like that. There is a process called NAET, of which I do this kind of work, which clears people's allergies to certain things like that. It's kind of a lengthy process. But I would generally say it must be some kind of an allergy that creates that. And if taking an aspirin keeps him from getting the headache, then maybe that might be his only option if he really wants to drink, I guess.
Okay. He doesn't drink a lot, but no. You know, it seems like every time he does have a beer, he gets a headache. And,
right.
He's about 39, and I think it just cropped up within the past year. So that can happen later in life.
Well, I think allergies, there are certain periods in life when people either get rid of allergies or they accumulate new ones, and that's a period where I think people's bodies once again start to change, and that might be well where it's at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. We're talking today with Jackie Gethner about holiday self-care. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 503-231-8187. And let's take another caller. Welcome to Health Watch.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question, perhaps a little bit outside of the fine lady guest's area of expertise, but as someone who works in the healing arts, I would value your opinion greatly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have problems with headaches this time of year. I do drink enough water, and I do try to work out to alleviate stress, etc. But I was wondering about heartache instead of headache. I'm a person who just had his 50th birthday on Thanksgiving, and at this point in my life, I am all alone. I lost my marriage of 14 years, and what's worse, my little girl, who just turned 9, lives 2,000 miles away from me. And every day that goes on, I feel like I die a little bit more inside, and I lose something that can never be gotten back. And thusly, you know, women who might enter into a relationship with me see this as a very detrimental factor. And I'm very honest about it. It's not the way I would want it to be. But I would value your opinion or comment on a situation this time of year when everyone seems to be surrounded by family or friends. It's a very hard pill to swallow to be alone.
I would totally, I can only say that I understand how you might feel. And a couple of things I would suggest is, first of all, I feel like it's hard for people to enter in relationships with other people when they're not feeling good about the care they have for themselves. And from listening to you, I would think that maybe is a little bit lower than you might even like it to be. So a couple of things. First of all, and this is not a quick fix, but back in the days when HIV first started and people used to go out and have these, what they used to call relationships that were like one-night stands kind of things to have needs met around being cared for, HIV came onto the picture, and a lot more people found their way into my office so that they could learn about how to nurture themselves versus being in these relationships that didn't work for them. So I'm offering that to you as a way to kind of get in touch with the parts of you that you really do like, so that when you do look at a relationship with someone else, you're not feeling that devoid hole quite as much, because to a lot of people, they've been through those kinds of relationships or been there themselves. And a relationship is a fair amount of work anyway, and you want to kind of start off on an even keel. The other thing I would suggest to you, and I certainly have had periods in my life where I have felt similarly to you, is that I find that when I go and do service for somebody else, it makes me feel better about what I do have, even if what I have isn't very much. So maybe that would be a possibility for you over the holiday, and maybe you'll run into somebody who's experiencing the same thing, and you can further that holiday, whether it turns into a relationship or even just as a friendship. That would be a way to reach out, and you wouldn't maybe be so alone.
All right. Well, I really value that answer. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you for being, you know, vulnerable enough to ask.
All right.
Thank you for the call.
All right. Bye-bye now.
So you offer a variety of workshops. Do any of them address this issue specifically of loneliness around or social isolation?
It certainly can. I really do workshops more based on when there is a need and enough people. You can pull any 6 or 8 people together, and I'm willing to do a workshop on pretty much anything. There's some people who can advertise and people will throng. That's never been my experience. It's more when someone says something like your last caller's response, and, you know, there are a couple of guys that would like to know more about this too, and then I'll create something that'll work specifically for them.
Is part of the self-nurturing you're referring to, being a massage therapist, do you teach self-massage techniques that would be part of that?
I do. I go in and work with couples and teach them how to work on each other. I go in and work with families and teach them how they can all support each other through touch. And I also do things with families that have a child with special needs so that the other children in the family can feel like this child does more than drain the parents' energy, and they can participate in this child's life a little bit more than just the basic eating or changing of diapers and those things. Yes.
We're talking today with Jackie Gethner about holiday self-care. If you'd like to join the conversation on the Health Watch, the number is 503-231-8187. And let's take another caller. Welcome to Health Watch.
Thank you. I have a question that's kind of related to the last callers. About 20 years ago, due to kind of relationship stress and also being a young kid unprepared for that kind of thing, I had cancer, and that forced me to kind of work on myself a lot in some of those self-caring ways that you were talking about. Now it's 20 years later, and the cancer was in my lungs, and I kind of get a pneumonia kind of reaction about 5 times in the last 3 years. I've had pneumonia. I kind of think that some of it's stress-related, but also I think it's related from a previous condition. And my question was if you had any kind of advice about this upper respiratory kind of infection that people are having that leads to pneumonia. And one other question was regarding the herb Lomatium. I don't know if you're using herbs, either of you, and I've seen that. I've found that Lomatium kind of helps with some lymphatic cleansing and infections that way.
Well, as far as the herb is concerned, Jackie was gesturing to me that Lomatium is a great antiviral herb. So if you're having particularly viral pneumonia, that's certainly something you could consider using. Did you have some things you wanted to add, Jackie, about upper respiratory infections?
Yes, I am. Once your lungs get vulnerable, which certainly cancer is going to make them vulnerable, they're going to need a little bit more of a boost. There's a number of aromatherapy concoctions that I make for people, you know, that are really individually made. So I can't say, well, you do this, this, and this.
Sure.
But they include things like eucalyptus and red thyme and clove and nutmeg and sometimes tea tree so that you can use on the chest that will help to keep things from maybe getting to the pneumonia phase. One of the things that I feel, though, is that people are not as germ conscious as they could be in terms of how easily you can pick things up. I'm a big proponent of hydrogen peroxide and vinegar in a spray, taking bottles of it when you travel on the plane so you can wipe down faucets and stuff. I mean, it seems so minor, but you do not know what's been there before. And if your body is at all compromised, you're going to be a lot more apt to pick up an infection of that kind. I'm really pretty much of an intuitive person, and what I would also share with you is that part of what you're saying to me feels kind of in an emotional response. And that is something that is a bodywork issue, where you look at the emotional components that create physical symptoms in the body, which is part of what I do in my practice. So it's not about just you should come in and see me for an appointment, but it's something that you really might look at and how to strengthen that area so that you aren't so vulnerable there.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I would add is if you're getting chronic repetitive respiratory infections, is to look at your diet too, that mm-hmm. there may be some hidden food allergies that, if were identified and removed, could make a difference in your immune defenses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call. Again, we're talking today with Jackie Gethner about holiday self-care. If you'd like to join the conversation here on Health Watch, it's 503-231-8187. So before we had this group of callers, we were talking a little bit about overindulgence with food, and that seems like a complicated issue to me in the holiday season, partly because people perhaps are not eating the way they would want to, and other times maybe because they're actually wanting to eat these foods and feeling guilty for it. So there might be a strange psychological relationship to what they're eating. Is there a way you untangle that mess for people?
Well, not easily in less than 5 minutes, but I would just point out the fact that, and this isn't new information for anybody, when you sit down to eat, that you use a smaller plate than you usually would use so it looks more full. But also look at why you're eating. Am I eating because I'm really hungry, or am I eating because I'm really bummed out because I have no one to spend the holidays with and I'm at this party and there's all this food? I think that that's a huge, huge factor in a lot of people's eating and overindulging, as well as with alcohol and other kinds of substances. And I'd also like to just point out before we close, because I don't know that we'll have enough time, is that the other issue that I see a lot of is people not being able to sleep, and especially kids when you're trying to do all that last-minute stuff. I would really encourage you, if you have kids that are kind of hard to deal with this time of the year, that you do some gentle foot massage and chamomile tea at night, or throw a pot of chamomile tea in their bathtub and let them soak in it. It really helps them sleep better, and it'll give you a little more free time to get caught up on the things you need to do at night. Adults also might have that issue because of expectations of families and, you know, did I do the right thing by inviting this person, or whatever the issues are. So again, the use of lavender as an essential oil on your pillow or your pajamas, and just doing some slow, deep breathing when your mind's going crazy and it's 2:30 at night, will probably help you a lot in terms of getting some good rest, because you certainly don't want to get sick right before Christmas, and as cold as our weather is, and I think it's supposed to rain today, it's just going to make people a lot more vulnerable.
And you mentioned chamomile and lavender for sleeping. Would you recommend something similar for general anxiety in the daytime too? And are there other things you might recommend for people in anticipation of the holidays, or right, during the holidays for that matter?
Well, as I suggest to people, just get a package of Post-its and put breathe everywhere you spend time, because it's so easy to remember this very basic thing called breathing. But it's such an automatic response that we really don't pay attention unless there's somebody like me saying, you need to take a breath, you need to take a breath. So that would be my one suggestion. My second suggestion would be, again, the lavender oil. People are looking at essential oils these days as they are over-the-counter drugs, and oils really do have some negative benefits, or negative attributes to them, rather. And even when you're on certain meds, they can have some implications. So I think I would feel more safe just talking about chamomile, which most people, the chamomile oil smells like wet hay to them, and they're not really particularly into the chamomile oil. But chamomile tea with a little bit of honey works really great, and the lavender. There's over 200 kinds of lavender that we have just even in Oregon. So just because one place has one kind of lavender doesn't mean you can't go someplace else and find another kind. But in order to be a good consumer about essential oils, please remember that they will be in a darker glass bottle because they're sensitive to the light and heat. If it says fragrance or it's in a clear bottle, it's not probably a pure oil.
And you've mentioned a couple times, Jackie, foot massage, and and I know you do what's called foot reflexology, and I was wondering if you could just very briefly touch on what that is for people who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. You have over 7,000 nerve endings in your body, and they all end in your hands and your feet. And generally, the spine is the dividing line, so everything on the left side is on the left foot and the right side right foot, with, of course, a few exceptions. So, you know, when I talk with people and they say when they get home, what's the first thing they do? They take their shoes off. And it's because their feet need more space. Most shoes these days are made pretty poorly, and so they don't give the support, which can then influence other parts of the body.
So do you recommend any particular resources, any favorite book or website that talks more about either self-massage or foot reflexology?
I really don't know about the self-massage. There's a book by Laura Norman called Feet First, and it's a very good book on foot reflexology. I think you'll find, like with everything else, that different authors have different ideas about how things are. So when you read something, don't just take it as the Bible. You need to know that there are some different views about how different modalities are achieved. But there are a lot of books that are included even in the library. You don't need to buy anything to be able to get some of this information.
And let's I'm sure we have listeners out there who want to know more about where they can learn more about your workshops and your practice. So if you could share some of that contact information, that would be great.
Sure, that's great. My phone number is 503-790-0974, and it's not listed in the phone book, so you'll have to call the station if you didn't get it, but it's 503-790-0974. And the easiest way to get to my website is to go to Google and put in my name, which is JACKIGETHNER, and then put /HIV and AIDS, because a lot of the work that I've done that would come up on Google is through my work in the HIV arena. And then it'll just go to my website from there, or you can call the station, I think, and they'll give it to them also.
Any final thoughts for people today?
I just want people to have a wonderful holiday, and no matter what's going on, right or wrong, just to know it's all part of a continuum, and that I just hope that everybody has a better, a healthier, and a more peaceful next year.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch, Jackie.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
We were talking today with Jackie Gethner, licensed massage therapist. Please stay tuned for The Dirtbag.
It's 10:30. You're tuned to KBOO Portland Community Radio. And coming right up, it's the Dirtbag today, Claudia Groth. in my finest Spanish language class pronunciation, Claudia Groth. She and Glenn Andreessen are going to talk about the most interesting mollusks in our gardens, that is slugs. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Way of Health, a nonprofit health clinic. No, that's not right. That was last time. Uh-oh. You know, I'm going to read this anyway because I was supposed to read one at 10:30 and I read it before I was supposed to. So I'm going to read this one. This is the outro. The outro, supporter person. The Way of Health, a nonprofit health clinic emphasizing internal medicine. You know what? I read this one already. Okay, we don't have one. I guess I read them all. Glenn, you ready for your show now? Here we go.
Reached the second Monday of the month. It must be time for the Dirt Bag, and indeed it is. Good morning, Glenn Andreessen, here beside you now until 11 o'clock. With me this morning, the reigning queen of slugs, perhaps Claudia Groth.
I'm not clear who I took that title from to become the reigning queen.
Well, my wife has told me that there is the slug queen in the Eugene celebration.
Yes, they do crown one down there, and also in, isn't it the Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, has the slug, the banana slug as their mascot?
I see. Oh, you mean the their the college. Yes.
Right. So they definitely probably crown a slug queen down
Well,
there.
See, I told you. Here she already is spouting off wisdom about these the mollusks. Yes, they are a member of the mollusk, closely related to clams and...
And the other mollusks.
And the other mollusks, yes, too. So.
And they can be a tasty treat.
Tammy says octopi.
There you go.
Uh-huh. Yes, they can be eaten, but I don't think that it's generally practiced here in... Portland?
No, I have not seen that.
So I've known Claudia for many a year now. I believe probably initially through the Master Gardener program. She's very active, in fact, is the past president or current president of the Multnomah County?
Current president for another, 15 days.
Okay.
And then I take on that fabulous past president role.
And it's a good one.
It's a good one.
Institutional knowledge is a good thing to have in your organization. Or the legislature, for that matter. So, it's a big subject, and there's a lot of misconceptions and probably just unknown facts about slugs, and we'll talk about that and whatever else we can come up with in the next 25 minutes.
All right.
So we need to differentiate between our native slugs and all the other slugs that we generally find in our gardens.
Yes.
I poll people a lot of time. You know, how many have ever found a banana slug in their Portland garden? And some people are misinformed. And
yes, I bet not many.
Well, some, I've heard like one or two, but they live right next to a woodland.
Right.
So
yeah, they're not our garden pests, no.
Okay, so describe what a banana slug is and then all those others.
Banana slug is the big one. It's 6-8 inches long, and of course it can extend itself even longer if it has to. They can extend 11 times their body length, so fit through a soda straw, if they have to. Yeah. So if your little tomato is on the other side of that soda straw, look out. So those are native, and we have many even of the smaller slugs that are native, but generally they're not the ones that are eating our gardens.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 40 slug species that were found here, and 16 of them are exotics. The ones come from out of town,
non-native,
as it were.
We'll say.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yes, out of the country generally, and those are the ones that have become a problem because they did not bring their predators and their diseases with them when they came.
And do we have European settlers to blame for that?
We do.
Okay. My ancestors, I must say.
Mine too.
Okay.
We brought the German and the English versions here. Yes, they have come on, originally came with the settlers. But today, even today, they're being introduced on a variety mm-hmm. of materials. People bring them in actually for food, and so then they get loose. That's how some of them got started, and they'll come in on plant material because we're bringing in lots of cool mm-hmm. plant material that we love in our gardens, and sometimes it can come in there too. That's why we have the Plant Health Service that watches for stuff coming in. So there's something our government's doing for us.
The horse is out of the barn, Claudia. Well, you know, the biggest one, I think it's a mollusk, the green... what is it? The green clam or green something? That's the little tiny one that's in in riverways now these days.
That is, yeah.
Just taking over feeding areas.
Right. One of the big sources for snails coming into the country is in Italian clay tile. Because they make the tile in Italy is heavily snail infested, and they get on the tiles, they get put in containers, and here they come. And so that's one of the areas where the plant health people are watching for and quarantining to make sure that these guys aren't coming in. So
we've established that the pests in our garden are really the non-natives, even though there may be some excuse me. A few are the smaller slugs, maybe native.
Right,
But we'll hardly ever find the banana slug in, you know, your vegetable garden, et cetera.
No.
And so what are these native or non-native slugs look like? I mean,
they can look like anything. My personal favorite is the spotted one, that one that has like the leopard spots on it.
Uh-huh.
It can be even kind of yellowish with the black spots or mostly gray with these beautiful black spots on it and very, very attractive. Slug, and you know, Glenn, maybe we should tell people as I'm describing these as attractive. The slugs are my friends. I like them, and I'm interested in them, and I do not kill them in my garden. So,
well, you go beyond that, though, Claudia. Let's fess up here.
Okay, I do have from time to time terrariums where I put little plants and moss and everything in there, and keep them in the house and make sure that. They're sprayed down several times a day.
Yeah.
Okay, sometimes I do that.
She appreciates them for what they are, and we can too.
I do. They're very interesting, and I certainly don't begrudge anyone trying to keep their garden from being killed by mm-hmm. these guys, because they can absolutely devastate a row of carrots in some cases, or lettuce, their favorite, I think, and they just do incredible damage in a short period of time.
And we'll talk about some slug control measures a bit later on, but where, or when's the best time, or what's this, let's talk about the physiology of a slug, when it mates, when it, you know, when it's out and active, or...
Right. Now they're not too active now because it's so cold, but they will be active... throughout most of our normal winter here mm-hmm. in Oregon, they'll down to 40 degrees. They still will come out. So when we're having our 50 and 60 degree winter days, they're going to be out and nudging around, looking for whatever's out there. And mostly there are scavengers. They eat what's starting to decay on the ground, and anything soft and coming up. The first things they get after in my garden are my daylilies, because those come up early.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really mow them down. But by summer, they're just fine. So they're looking for any little thing in the winter. But they're active in the winter, and they're moving around. But of course, in spring, they're going to hatch out all those eggs that are underneath the ground right now, underneath rocks. And I know you've found some in your garden from time mm-hmm. to time. They're very, very pretty. They're little, about an eighth of an inch to maybe a little bigger. They can be 5 or 6 of them, or up to 40 or 50 of them in a little pile together. And folks can find them under the mulches, under the under rocks, under pots. They'll be buried down a couple inches. They can even bury them down a couple inches to keep them protected over the winter. So that's what they're doing now. Then in spring, they'll all hatch out, and away they'll go. And so you'll see a lot of really tiny ones in the spring.
So they then they get bigger.
Then they get much bigger.
Do they molt?
No. Okay, they just get bigger. Right.
So they all start out very small. Even if they're growing up to 3 inches long, they start out.
Exactly. Yeah, they start very tiny. My cat brought in one the other day. I thought it was just a leaf or some piece of dirt that fell off her fur, and and until it, you know, the little tentacles came out and it started zooming across my desk. So then I threw it back outside. So they are out there hatching out even now. In spring, they don't all get to be the size of banana slugs.
Sure.
Some of them only get to be an inch, but some of them get to be 3 inches, like that leopard spotted one I was talking about. They could be 3-4 inches long.
And do they prefer a certain type of food based upon the species? For example, do they prefer lettuce, fresh lettuce, over dying or decaying material on the ground?
They prefer something that's soft and easy to chew. And so they're going to go after something like lettuce, which is very succulent. But they're in the forest, their favorite food is fungus, like mushrooms or any kind of mm-hmm. fungus type thing. So they like something that's soft. They don't have to do a lot of work. They're very lazy.
Well, they're can you tell us about their tongues?
They're so-called tongues. Yes, they have. I think people probably have seen the advertisements that say, you know, they have 35,000 teeth. Actually, they have 35,000 little tiny bumps that are very rough on what seems to be their tongue. And what they do is kind of throw this tongue out and grab the leaf and then rake it back in their very hard upper part of their mouth. And so they just kind of shred the leaf, which is what you see. They just kind of shred it, and then it goes back in their throat and down the tummy.
I've always kind of compared it to a wood file, or a rasp.
Yes.
You can just imagine that, you know, rasping that against your skin or something like that, the plant doesn't stand a chance.
It does not. And also, they're very inquisitive. If you hold them on your hand, they will check to see if your food. And so you'll feel that on your on your hand if you hold one, and it's interested in food, which they usually are. And so you can just feel it's like a little cat's tongue. You can feel that little rasp on there as it checks you out to see if you're food.
I'm speaking with Claudia Groth here this morning, talking about her favorite
mollusk.
Garden pest.
Yeah, right.
And... And we're going to get to the, let's talk about some control measures then.
Okay. The main thing about control is to understand the pest, understand the little guy and his behavior and his biology, what he's going to be doing, where he's going to be, so you can, you know, kind of, it's kind of a know your enemy type thing. So we all know where they are. They're hiding under the shrubbery, under your perennials, under the leaves. There's someplace dark during the day because the sun will dry them out and they'll die. So you've got ground covers, you've got some kind of board or something. So they're going to rock garden. I have lots of rocks in my garden. rock walls and things like that. So they're going to be hiding all in there. So, and they're going to be hungry at the end of the day, at the end of the night. So in the morning, at the end of the day. So at night, they're going to want to come out and eat because they're hungry. So that would be a great place to put the bait because they're going to see it first. You know, you don't want them to have a long march into the garden where your lettuce is. You know, just know where they are, think about where they might be,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, put the bait there if you're going to bait with them. Now, you also can do barriers. The copper is a great barrier, especially for the snails. I've heard different reports on the copper for slugs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a raised bed, you could put the copper around the raised bed to make a barrier. Sanitation is another good thing to remember because they're going to be under all the pots and under all kinds of boards or any kind of stuff you leave in the garden. So a nice clean garden is another way to control them when you think about their biology because they want to get down during the day someplace nice and cool and moist. And so if you've got a lot of boards and trashy stuff around your yard, that's where they're going to be, right mm-hmm. next to where your plants are. So,
and I'll just interject here, too, is that it reminds me that some people do use boards between, or I've used boards even, between cabbage plants or something like that. So they'll hide under those boards, and then come daybreak, they'll hide under there, and then early in the morning I can go out and look under the boards and dispose of them or collect them for my terrarium or whatever I need.
Whatever you need. Just check them out, say hello. that's very true. That's a great way to do it. Any kind of trap like that, even if you're not using some kind of chemical to kill them, any kind of trap like that, that's a great way. You attract them there. I usually, when I'm catching them or trying to mm-hmm. attract them, I'll use brewer's yeast mixed with lettuce and kind of chop it up
oh.
so it's bruised and smelling, you know, kind of exciting to them. And so then you find them in the morning, scrape them out. One gal I know, she throws all hers into her yard debris bag, and then the city comes and takes them away. So she's now worried that they might crawl out because they can
sure.
move, you know, with some alacrity when they need to. But there's no reason for them to move out of her yard debris bucket. There's all
right.
It's moist and there's a lot of food. So that's what she does. She collects them and throws them all in there. So it's a good way.
So do you want to talk about or mention anything about the effectiveness of the of dry abrasive materials as a barrier?
I've seen photos of slugs crawling across ground glass. Their mucus that they put out on their foot, the underside, it's very effective. They put out a lot of it. They can move over any kind of abrasive material if they have to. Certainly, they're going to want to do that less than to move across something that's more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly you can use those, but it's going to be more of a deterrent than an absolute barrier.
Right.
Especially in our nice, moist, humid environment.
During the summer, I've used pretty effectively diatomaceous earth, which is not only microscopically sharp, but it also acts as a desiccant.
Right.
So which just dries the slug out. But we frequently get heavy dews
right.
every morning or late night, I suppose, and it just renders it ineffective.
Useless, right, yeah. Yeah, that's part of our problem just here because of our nice humidity.
Which is another reason that the slugs like it here.
They love it here.
Right, because they don't have this protective covering like snails do with the shell, so they... that's why they seek shelter every night.
Exactly. And they're very good at getting down in the cracks of the ground between the soil and, you know, say a stem that the wind kind of blows around and
makes
a little bit of a space there, and they can just zoom down there, and that's a great place for them to spend the day.
We talked earlier before the show about a lot of times new gardeners will ask about the wisdom of my recommendation to put down leaves in the fall. Just don't leave. In other words, I don't want that soil bare out there. And they say, well, isn't that just an attractant for slugs?
Right.
And we both agreed that the benefit from having a mulch material down just far outweighs the possible risk of
slugs.
But
it is a balance, as
sure.
with all of our things in the garden. It is a balance. We need to think about, I'd rather be protecting my soil from the pounding rain. I'd rather be not having weeds pop up or, you know, during the winter. And I'd rather have adding organic matter. It's just... mulches are just worth the effort, and I was saying to you, I do that, and I don't kill the slugs at all in my yard, and I still have a great yard
mm-hmm.
with grasses and shrubs, perennials. I even have a hosta, but I have a blue hosta, which they don't like blue as well as much as they would one of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I have loads of bleeding hearts, which they don't like. So I have a lot of great plants, columbine. I have a lot of great
sure.
plants, and that the slugs don't seem to mind. Have you ever had any experience with the cocoa mulch and
no.
the slugs?
Mm-mm.
I put cocoa mulch down in one area, and this is just totally my own experience, one area, and the daffodils in that area never get eaten by slugs, whereas my daffodils in the other part of the rock garden do mm. get kind of shredded. So I'm kind of...
I might.
Liking the cocoa mulch. Of course, it smells like chocolate, so where's the bad?
Yeah. And have you any experience with coffee grounds?
I do not. I have not.
But you've read about these experiments where apparently
with the caffeine.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My thought was just to grind up some, you know, those no-dose pills and start spraying them. But yes, it's supposed to be not only a killing, but a deterrent. So
for slugs, right?
Yeah, found that in Hawaii in Orchid Greenhouse.
Now, I should mention that Claudia mentioned about the baits, if you're baiting for slugs, and there is a less toxic slug bait available that uses iron phosphate as its active ingredient. And as I found out for researching for a couple of columns now in the Portland Alliance, that those slug baits are not, they're not on the list, although it's possible that they could be. One of the rationales for turning it down for being on the list, and this is from the National Organics Program list, the USDA's
right.
national list, it was voted on 2-1. So one person said, yes, we should accept it, put it on the list, and two said no, and the reason was is that there are alternatives.
Oh.
Well, I don't think these guys live in Portland.
I don't
Portland.
Think they do.
Because there are alternatives for just hand controlling
sure.
it in your small backyard. I mean, you might be able to, you could probably keep up with them.
Right. In our state alone, I mean, the grass growers are devastated by these. They're up on the tops eating the tops off the grasses.
Right.
And so they are a terrible pest here. And hand picking in grass seed fields or in, you
yeah.
know, is not really practical.
Right. So I talked to a farm reviewer for Oregon Tilth, and he said he was kind of optimistic that it eventually would be approved for use. But we still couldn't call it organic in the strictest sense because it's not an organic product. Even though the iron phosphate is found naturally, it's not found in these high concentrations that are necessary to do in the slugs.
Yeah, and it's also not carbon-based, which is another definition
right.
of organic, so very confusing issue.
And I try to make some sense of that in the January issue of the Portland Alliance, so you can look for that. And I will have this representative on, John Staley is his name, from Oregon Tilth, but it won't be until probably March or April. He's just too busy now, so we'll try to get that, we'll make more sense of that.
Yeah.
Later.
And whatever baits people use, they need to be careful with them.
Right.
You know, to protect wildlife and the dogs.
Yeah, the metaldehyde-based baits are, you know, if you talk to the vets, you know, that's, you know, it's not a pretty sight,
no,
you know, for the dogs going for that. So.
But there are so many traps
right.
you can make to protect, you know, to make it safer. You should never pile them in piles because they do look like dog food, or cat food. Many of the baits do. Excuse me. You should scatter them, which is what they say on the package.
Right.
So there are things you can do to
well, I make it even better. Though the the iron phosphate based baits are not on the list, I will probably continue to use them. I'm not a certified garden.
Right.
Mine's not certified, and it's those little tiny ones. Although, you know, I need to be clear here that even the iron phosphate baits are not effective against all species of slugs.
No.
I found that to be true, too. And so,
from what I heard from some of the researchers down at Oregon State, the other OSU, they're not quite as effective, but we're not going to be getting 100% of the slugs out there. Mm-hmm. We're looking for control, not eradication.
Right. And my first line is just when I see them, unlike just take off your headphones here, Claudia.
Right.
I just have my pruners with me and away they go.
Yeah, my mom was big on using that method for the tomato hornworms, which was a big pest back east where I grew up. Yeah.
So maybe the final, we just have a minute or two left. You know what? Do you have any words of wisdom on the slime on your fingers?
Yes. Slime attracts water. It absorbs water. So you don't want to use water to wash it off. You want to maybe take a little dirt out of the garden and kind of rub it between your hands, and that'll kind of ball up like rubber cement. It's more like rubber cement.
Yeah.
Rub your hands together and get most of it off that way, and then wash your hands.
I've always compared it to like pitch. It's on there.
It's good.
Right.
A little vinegar also.
Now, just briefly here, we do have one or 2 minutes. Natural predators of slugs.
Encourage snakes.
Indeed.
Birds will get some of them. Toads, the darkling ground beetles, those are those quick-running black beetles you see in the garden. They quickly run for cover. Those are predators.
Of slugs or slug eggs?
Slugs,
both.
They're very quick, and so they can run down a slug.
You don't have to be quick to do that.
Well, 132 feet per hour. They're moving along. So those ground beetles, and there's some other ground beetles. Actually, they will prey on each other's slug eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them will. Some of the eggs will go that way. Toads, slugs, birds. And some of them will actually eat, kind of prey on each other.
Right.
So
it just sums up what we're dealing with here. We've got the introduction of non-native species, which you mentioned so eloquently that they didn't bring with them their predators or disease.
Right.
The predators that they might have, birds, snakes, toads. Well, certainly snakes and toads. I haven't seen a snake or a toad in my garden.
No, me neither.
And I live in the inner northeast, somewhat inner northeast, and you live in northeast too.
Yeah.
and then we get further infill, which takes away all the habitat for the
predators.
Right. So it's just a spiral down.
And then we clean our gardens. We keep them all too neat, and which doesn't
Perfect.
Help. Yeah, if we plant, well, it's always been that way. Plant two for the pests and one for you. So,
well, yeah, and my response is they don't know what's for them and what's for me. They'll take a bite out of everything.
That's right.
So it's better just to try to keep up with them.
Yes.
Handpick. Know thy enemy.
Know your enemy
and
be able to
understand what they are. And if you see those slug eggs, what I normally do is just expose them to the elements if I'm digging around this time of year.
Absolutely.
Or any time. They generally lay their eggs mostly in
September and October.
Right?
You bet.
So do they have just one life cycle per year?
No, they can lay throughout the year. Some of them. Depends on the species.
Right. And the slugs are hermaphrodites. They have both sexual components.
Right.
But it takes two to tango.
It does take two to tango, usually. There are
usually,
some species
yeah.
that can self-fertilize, but they both come away pregnant.
That's a happy note to end on. Well, thanks a lot, Claudia, for sharing your information with us and spending the morning. Claudia Groth, the reigning slug spurt, as my wife said. Thanks a lot, Tammy. We'll see you in January.
It's 11 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO in Portland. And now here is that underwriting script that I missed at the last half hour. This KBOO, the previous KBOO program, has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from One Green World, a nursery located near Molalla, Oregon, offering hard-to-find plants designed to help you grow your own fruit and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. For a color catalog, the number is 503-651-3005, and the email address is catalog@onegreenworld.com. Coming right up, it's Democracy Now! Stay tuned for that and all the rest of the great programming here on Community Radio KBOO.